Would any executive who had other options ever choose to eat a boxed lunch? Like,
well, it's like anything that's executive. It's always, the name is always two levels of status up from the thing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a marketing name, you know. So executives would never have an executive boxed lunch. 17-year-olds don't read 17 magazine, and on and on. Aspirational. I don't think executives have any form of lunch that comes in a box. They should call it executive sack lunch.
Like, there's literally, like, there is nothing they could put in that box that would make that name seem reasonable.
It's just filled with caviar. Sack Lunch, the famous movie from Seinfeld.
To begin with follow-up today, friend of the show Daniel Jalkett has spent what seemed to be a surprising amount of time doing research on Moscone lunches, and I'm glad that Daniel did it so we don't have to. He has looked up some information about the Moscone box lunches. We'll put a link in the show notes. There's a few highlights that I wanted to call everyone's attention to. The, quote, executive box lunch, quote, is $39.25 in the year 2017, according to Daniel.
I love so much that this is called the executive box lunch.
Yes, the executive box lunch. I am not kidding.
I mean, in all fairness, Craig Federighi was allegedly eating one of these things backstage before Talk Show Live, and he is an executive. And so, therefore, right. I guess that's aptly named. But I tell you one thing, when all of us are eating it in the big dining hall, I sure don't feel like an executive.
No.
It seems like, well, it's not, keep going, Casey, because it's not, $39 does not include all of the pricing and options included in this special Porsche lunch. If you want the floor mats and all four wheels and also a transmission, it costs more.
Yes. So continuing on, this is the description of the executive box lunch, which Daniel notes. It's what he remembers from DubDub, and it sounds the same to me. So the description is as follows. Four compartment includes compostable service, because California, 25 guest minimum. Sandwich, wrapper, entree, salad includes a choice of side salad, dessert, and fruit. To accompany your box lunches, we suggest adding assorted soft drinks and bottled water. Okay, so let's talk about soft drinks and bottled water. Soft drinks and water are not included. A 22% service fee, as well as sales tax, which is almost 10%, are also added to the price. So that $39.25 box lunch comes out to around $52, and you haven't had anything to drink yet. And this is Daniel writing, want to really lose your lunch? Each bottled water is $5.25, coming to $7 after service and taxes. And this is, again, still Daniel. And Marco's long-lost strawberry sea monster Adwala, which is probably classified as assorted juices, would set Apple back an additional $8 a bottle. Add it all up, and it's not hard to imagine that meals and snacks are coming to $100 a day or $500 a week per person, nearly a third of the $1,600 WWDC admission fee likely pays for food. Are you kidding me with this garbage? Moving on, I don't know how the people who do it in San Jose, how their box lunches compare, but the good news is the, quote, gourmet box lunch from the caterers in San Jose comes in at only $22. Mineral waters, soft drinks, juices, and bottled water are a mere $4.50 each. So a considerable savings once they move to San Jose on lunches alone. How can you spend $500 a week on those lunches? Like, I was sitting here mostly defending them the last couple of episodes. Yeah, they're not that bad. You know, they're passable. They work. Not at $500 for the week. Are you friggin' kidding me with this insanity? No, no, no. Hard pass. No.
So if they drop the price of the tickets by $500, like maybe they gave that $500 back to the people, and we all had to leave the building and find someplace else to eat and then come back, I'm actually not sure that that would be better for the conference. You're like, oh, just give me that $500. I could spend that in San Francisco. But then you got to go find someplace to eat. And I'm not sure the eateries that you can get to and back to the conference center in time to get the after-lunch sessions can support that many people or are any better. So,
oh, no, they're better, but they probably can't support the people. You're probably right about that, but they are definitely better.
I don't know. Like, I mean, it depends. Like, you can go to the, whatever, that little mall thingy that's over there, and I mean
the mall food court is better than the bar.
It is better, but you gotta wait in these long lines, and then you get your thing, and you gotta find someplace to eat it, and you gotta get back, and that's like the closest possible choice. I'm wondering, I would actually mostly be willing to pay for the convenience of not having to leave the conference center while eating lunches that I don't really like. Because that convenience is, I mean, and obviously the ideal choice would be to be able to get food from someplace else. But as Daniel points out, that is in their rules. You can't get food from anyplace else, in case it wasn't clear.
Yeah.
There is no choice. Apple can't say, oh, we're just going to, we're going to bring in, you know, someone else to cater. Nope, not even an option.
Yeah, it's just insanity to me. Like, how they can get fleeced that badly. It's not Apple's fault. It's just the way of the world. But, oh, my goodness. It is just barbaric that that's the answer.
Well, the way of the world in Apple world is like, if this bothered Apple all that much, just buy Moscone. Like, I mean, some of the things they could do. So I saw a tweet as I was catching up on my far behind on Twitter, someone saying that with its cash, Apple could buy all of the Major League Baseball, NFL, and NHL teams and still have $100 billion left over.
That's so crazy. Now, and then somebody, well, actually, that person, and was like, well, actually, that doesn't account for taxes. But still, the point stands. Like, it's preposterous. All right, let's talk about next iPhone rumors. We talked in the past that there may be a Touch ID button on the back of the phone, which some people think is the end of times. A lot of people like myself think, eh, whatever. But a couple people actually pointed out, well, what does this mean for the home button then? Because a home button on the back does not seem good. So how does that work? And I don't know is the answer, but I would guess that there is some sort of home button, even a faux home button on the chin of the front of the phone. I think that's what they've probably started down the path of, which with the immobile or non-movable, whatever the word I'm looking for is, home button on the iPhone 7. And maybe the whole thing becomes a home button. I'm not really sure, but it's certainly an interesting point I hadn't considered that, you know, today Touch ID and home button are, you know, kind of co-located, but in the future, maybe they won't be. So, John, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think they will be separate because it is more awkward to press a button on the back of the phone, even a fake, like, non-button. I mean, they can have it there in addition, I suppose, because, again, if it doesn't move, it's not as if they have to make room for some kind of mechanism, and it's already going to be this little cutout area. But I think they will continue to have a home button on the front of the phone. Now, whether that home button is virtual, kind of like the touch bar, where it's just a bottom section of the screen or something like that, there's been lots of rumors in the past that I haven't heard any recently about how the touch bar technology of having this little separate accessory screen controlled by the OS and you know, accessible to applications through an API, kind of like all, you know, the Android soft buttons and stuff like that, might be a thing that would appear on a phone. But even if that it doesn't exist at all, the idea of there being that you can squeeze the bottom part of your phone to go home, like whether you can want to consider that a button, and especially if it's completely embedded in the screen and there is no, it's just a flat featureless piece of glass with no little cutout or circle or whatever, we're still going to call that the home button. And I'm thinking that they're not going to get rid of that no matter where the Touch ID essentially goes. So it's basically a divorce of home button and Touch ID, where the home button can stay on the front, but because of the way it's done and the edge to edge screen and everything, the Touch ID sensor goes on the back, and we just squeeze the bottom of our phones. And I think I would mostly be okay with that, too. Like, again, I'll have to try it for a while to see if I missed the little indented circle. A lot of listeners wrote in to express love for the little indented circle as a way to feel like which end of your phone is up or, like, exactly where you have to squeeze. But if you can squeeze anywhere along the bottom edge of the phone, I guess then your only problem is if you have your thing upside down. But I suppose you have the lightning port to check whether that's the case. Anyway, it's pretty weird that all of these rumors about the next phone surround like actual important physical changes to the exterior of the phone, because all of the past phones, including like this, you know, 6 and 7 generations where it's kind of the same on the outside, have been about like, what does it look like and what are the materials? But the design of, it's a, you know, a rectangle with a circle button on the bottom that you press in to go home, and then I guess the addition of Touch ID, have been so constant. This is the first phone that's like, that the story on this phone is, it may be differently shaped, differently proportioned, and functionality on it may be moving around in ways that has never moved around before. So that's kind of exciting, and, you know, kind of also risky. And that, like, they have a model that works here with this rectangle with the home button on the bottom, and they've iterated and iterated and refined and iterated, and but basic, the basic functions and stuff have been the same, aside from, you know, Casey mentioned the last show that the power button moved to the side, which is somewhat explicable by the increasing size of the phone and the difficulty people would have reaching up to the top. But other than that, the phone design of the phone has been pretty oh yeah, and the headphone jack moving from top to bottom, but the physical design of the phone has been pretty constant. And I'm kind of excited to see them, you know, say all bets are off, we're moving things around and we're going to try something new.
So I actually had a chance to play with the Galaxy S8 a couple days ago in a Best Buy. With the exception of it feeling way too tall for its width, and it being hard to reach things as a result, I actually really enjoyed the general like look of the edge to edge on the sides screen and everything. And the way they did the home button, I just kind of instinctively like force touched the lower area where the home button would be on an iPhone. And it turns out that's exactly what they want you to do. And it just clicked, and it recognized any firm press in that area as a home button click. And so the very first thing I tried worked and was correct. And then as I was playing with it over a few minutes, I did that here and there a few more times, and every time it just worked exactly as expected. And even when there was something on screen there, you know, something from the foreground app that is in that spot, that, you know, if it misinterprets it as a touch, it would have activated that thing. But every time it interpreted it correctly, and it was great. It was totally fine. So, you know, if Apple's going to go in a direction like that where part of the screen just becomes the home button, I think they totally can. We've seen with the iPhone 7 force touch button that's a possibility. That's totally fine. And now we see with the S8 that it actually really does work. The only major question I would have for it is, how do they show this to people? Like how is it handled in the UI? Does the usable area of the screen for apps actually extend that far like it does on the S8? Or is there that little, like, you know, reserve, or like you were saying, John, like maybe like a touch bar like API area down there where, like, you know, apps would only actually take up like the middle 80% of the height, and, you know, maybe not the very top and bottom or something like that, you know. But anyway, having the just bottom area of the screen accept a firm touch as a home button, that works just fine.
I was going to ask if there are any accessibility implications for that, but I would suppose with that, I forget what you call it, but we talked about it a lot like several months ago, where you have the little on-screen button that lets you do the home button and like, and all sorts of other gestures. What's the name of that thing? You know what I'm thinking of?
Assistive touch, I think.
Yeah, assistive touch, something like that. Thank you. I was about to ask, you know, is this an accessibility issue? But I would suppose assistive touch would fix any of those problems. I'm not sure, but it's a change.
Well, the issue would be that you could no longer feel the button. Like, because, you know, now you can feel that ring, you know, so, you know, it's, like John was saying, like you can more easily tell like which direction the phone is oriented without like a physical depression on the front surface where the home button goes. It's harder to tell which way is up by feel alone. So that would be an issue for sure. And I don't know how they would solve that. Maybe you would just start getting used to feeling for like the camera bump or other features on the outside. I don't know.
If it is a dedicated area, they could do haptics to make it do the tiniest little jiggle when your finger is over the reserved bottom section of the phone. Like, there's all sorts of things they can do.
That's interesting.
Playing Switch games with its little, there's been a couple articles recently about the haptic engine in the Nintendo Switch, which looks like the same tech that Apple's been using in its phones. I forget what they're called, Linear something or other, or whatever, but it's better than the old vibrators and more precise. And they're using it in games, to make it feel like things on screen have some kind of physical presence. And it's surprisingly easy to fool us. I mean, we just talked about the home button last time. Like, it doesn't feel like a button, but it feels like a thing that we rapidly get used to and come to accept as the physical reality of the phone, right? And I think the best thing would be, like, if you could turn off, I mean, I suppose you can. Isn't there some way to turn off vibration entirely? Can you turn off the haptic engine entirely?
I would assume so, but I don't know.
Yeah, but anyway, if it did turn off, our devices would feel broken in a different way, because we'd be like, this is not how my glass rectangle is supposed to move or feel. So adding something like, oh, when your finger physically touches the correct bottom part of the phone, it gives the tiniest little jiggle, and that would be a physical way for you to feel with your hands which side is the top or bottom of my phone. It wouldn't activate anything yet because you haven't actually pressed, but basically when you're feeling for that little circle, you want to know which side is up. You need that information. You need that to be provided physically. That little circle is about as subtle as the little jiggle could be. And once you find which side is up, if the whole bottom of the phone functions as one giant button, it's even easier to hit than that little circle. So that problem is solved.
So real-time follow-up, to turn off System Haptics, which has a subtitle of Play Haptics for System Controls Interactions. That's in Settings, Sounds, and Haptics. And then there's options for Vibrate on Ring, Vibrate on Silent, Sound and Vibration Patterns, and all the way at the bottom is System Haptics, which is a switch yes-no.
Does that turn off the home button? Just switch them all and find out.
No, the home button still does a haptic click.
Yeah.
I presume because it would be really, really eerie if it didn't.
It would feel broken. I mean, to us, if you're used to it, it's like it's whatever you get used to, but it would feel like it doesn't, it's not the same physical device anymore.
Right.
That's the thing about haptics, like, oh, it's faking a physical. This gets another one of my pet peeves, that my you know, things being done in hardware on video cards, which is like now an increasingly dated peeve from the 80s. Mechanical keyboards, that phrase drives me nuts. Because, you know, like, please show me the non-mechanical keyboards.
I can do that. Do you remember when they used to have the ones that they would, like, shine? It looked like laser, like a laser keyboard, but it wasn't actually lasers, I'm sure.
Yeah, how did you use those keyboards, Casey?
You put your fingers on a surface.
You take your finger and you move it. You mean you take
No, you're missing the point. You're just shining light on a surface, say like on a desktop.
No, John's saying your finger's the machine.
I know what thing you're talking about, but you can't activate it with your mind. You have to physically move your hands and press them into certain areas. You don't have to press, but you have to place your fingers into the zone where the keys are. That is a physical action.
But the keyboard itself is not moving, John.
Wait, so like when a conductor waves the stick around in front of a band, is that considered a mechanical device?
You know, yeah. I would say, I don't know. It's it's difficult to say what you consider mechanical, because it's not like that light is just being emitted naturally from the desktop.
We need an episode of mechanical or not.
This is definitely a pretty broad definition of mechanical that you're using here, John.
Right.
Yeah,
I agree. But when people talk about, really, in the context I'm saying, when people talk about mechanical keyboards, they're saying, as compared to the keyboard that I'm sitting in front of, which is the Apple Aluminum Extended, which is 100% mechanical. The keys move, you know, making contact with a thing that causes a signal, but it's not a quote-unquote mechanical keyboard. It's a very strange interpretation.
Wait, can I nitpick your definition of 100% mechanical?
Yeah, what part of it isn't mechanical?
I'm pretty sure there's like a USB controller in there and a bunch of...
No, I mean the keyboard part of it. I mean, it's the same thing with mechanical keyboards. When you're just activating a switch, it's still electronic. It's not like it's steam powered. It's not like a typewriter where you're hitting a lever that's causing a big thing to whack into a piece of paper that makes your key.
Jason Snell, can you fix this for us so we don't have to do
it? I know what people mean when they say mechanical keyboards. It's just a silly phrase. Like it is a term that has taken on this alternate meaning that doesn't really make sense if you think about it, but it is accepted as a term of art, so we all just say it and don't think about it.
Help me, Jason Snell. You're my only hope.
But what I was getting at before I derailed myself,
I get that reference,
was the idea that that haptics are a replacement for things like the physical home button, right? When they're not, you know, they work by doing a physical thing. Something in your phone is moving, causing you to feel that motion. It's just an entirely different motion than the surface that you pressed moving downwards relative to the surface surrounding it. But something is moving, and it is, and you are feeling it as a physical sensation. So it is an alternate physical action to replace other physical actions. It is not the removal of like physical buttons with non-physical buttons, because I would say the iPhone 7 button is still a physical button when haptics are turned on, because you press as a physical action and you tell that your press has been registered or successful because you feel a response. The response is not your finger getting lower inside the thing, but it is a physical sensation. And so this distinction between physical and non-physical controls, as haptics get better, like, I mean, maybe it'll be like mechanical keyboards. It's just that that's the way we'll describe it. And, you know, we won't bother thinking about whether it makes sense or not. But it is a clever way to make a device more reliable while still doing the thing that works best with humans. We have, you know, hands and fingers that are sensitive and, you know, that are sensitive to motion. And it's a good way to tell how things are happening without looking at them. So you can feel in your pocket, just like a physical, you know, physical buttons as opposed to those non-physical buttons. I can feel where the volume controls are. I can feel where the power button is. I can feel where the home button is. I can feel that it has been activated. I can physically press it. All that stuff plays to the strengths of our hands and fingers, which is how we use our iPhones. And so anything Apple does related to that is wise to leverage those abilities. In the same way the Touch Bar tries to do that, but because it has no haptics, you are left with kind of a surface that you have to look at more than you would otherwise, and you can press on it, but it's more like a touch screen in that it doesn't do anything when you press any of those things, which is another reason a lot of people have difficulties with the Touch Bar, is that it is replacing buttons with something that is less button-like. Whereas I feel like the iPhone 7 home button replaced a button with something that is, it's like an alternate take on a button, but it is, you know, it's like they replaced the function keys on the MacBook with the screen from the iPhone. The screen is not the same kind of a button because they don't know where the buttons are going to be. But on the Touch Bar, it seems like you could know they were kind of, you know, anyway, this is just my mild musings on haptics, but I think they are long term. I think there's legs to this whole haptic thing. I mean, you know, as Apple has been so excited and proud to show its little, you know, how much better the vibration is in each phone and this haptic engine that they brand with this haptic stuff. I think they're actually onto something there. I think we'll just see more and more of that from Apple and other companies because it works with humans. That could be Apple's slogan since they're not doing the computer with the rest of us anymore. Computer for the rest of us anymore. It works with humans, TM.
We are sponsored this week by Casper, an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Go to casper.com/ATP and use code ATP for $50 towards your mattress. Casper created one perfect mattress, and they sell it directly to consumers, which eliminates commission-driven inflated prices. The award-winning Casper mattress was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a surprisingly small box, so you can actually get it up your staircase if you have narrow stairs. And they also offer an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. Now, the mattress industry has been full of notoriously high markups forever. Casper has revolutionized it by cutting the cost of dealing with all these resellers and showrooms and passing the savings to you. The in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper mattress with supportive memory foams for a sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And the breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. And they've made buying mattresses online, which sounds kind of crazy, completely easy and risk-free. Here's how they do it. They offer free delivery in that wonderful box and free returns within a 100-night home trial. So you get to sleep on it for over 3 months. And if you don't love it, they will pick it up at your house and give you a full refund. It's that easy. They understand the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, because you're going to be spending a third of your life on it. Now, we've heard from friends and listeners who've all had great things to say about the Casper mattress. Time magazine even named it one of the best inventions of the year when it came out. So get yours today and try it for 100 nights in your own home with free delivery and free returns with home pickup, completely all risk-free. Go to casper.com/ATP and use code ATP for $50 towards your mattress. Thank you very much to Casper for sponsoring our show.
Let's talk about Wiki Tribune, of which I know basically nothing, and I am failing at my job as chief summarizer in chief. So, Marco, I feel like I saw you tweeting about this when it first broke. Do you want to kind of fill us in as to what Wiki Tribune is about?
Honestly, I barely know. I just signed up because I wanted to support this cause. So, John, can you give a better summary than I can?
This has been in the notes for like 3 weeks, people. But I think one place we can start is Marco with his lack of knowledge. Why did you decide to sign up for this? What did you do by signing up? Did you like have to give money or pledge to give money? Like what was the sign up thing that you did?
It's some kind of like pre-commitment type system like Kickstarter, but like I don't think they're going to charge me until they hit their minimum, or unless they hit their minimum, something like that.
But it is a money thing. Like you're supporting this effort with money, right?
Yeah, I sign up to make a monthly donation or whatever it is to.
All right. So what led you to do that?
Well, basically, there's a lot of things about journalism these days that I think are really dysfunctional or broken, and this seems like it could fix some of them. Not all of them. I don't think it's probably possible to fix all of them, but this could fix some of them in a fairly big way. So if it works, that'll be great. If not, I lost a little bit of money along the way, and then I'll stop losing it when I cancel it. That's it. It seems like a good cause. I feel like all of the Wikipedia donation prompts that I've ignored over the years and closed over the years without giving, I feel like maybe I owe something to Jimmy Wales' causes. So here I'm going to finally make that good, I guess.
So to go back and give a vague summary of what the heck this thing is, it is from the Wikipedia guy. You've seen his face at the top of Wikipedia asking for money. Now you can see his face on a different website asking you for money for a different thing. So it has the pedigree of, you know, Wikipedia, which is a tremendously successful community platform for doing whatever it is people do on Wikipedia. And this is about trying to make the news better, like Marco said. He's got the same, some of the same complaints about news and the incentive structures and how it doesn't lead to good information being disseminated. And there's lots of anti-patterns and with how it's funded and what gets published and how it's published and versus what people want to read and you know, what sells ads and so on and so forth. So this is a sort of Wikipedia-style approach to news where it's very open and transparent. So you, everyone who's reading it can see what's going on. There's no ads, so you don't have to worry about the entire thing being made to, you know, to drive ad views, which is a problem in the web in general, not just on, you know, news and everything like that. And like Wikipedia, it is community-oriented, where it's not just like these people produce the content and the rest of the world reads it. Everybody participates in theory, making the things better, although there are professional journalists involved as well. So it's not just like, hey, make up whatever you want and publish whatever you want, because that's just called the web. That's not anything. And trying to, be transparent to the people who are giving money. Like, you know, how are they going to fund all this? Through people like Marco, the same way Wikipedia is funded. How does Wikipedia exist? Jimmy Wales' head asks you for money every once in a while. And there are, I'm assuming they're investors or stuff like that. And they have this kind of Venn diagram at the top where it shows three circles. And the three circles are community, facts, and journalists. And Wiki Tribune is the confusing diamond-shaped intersection of three of those circles. When I see the intersection between three circles, I don't get a diamond shape, but it's a logo. There's some creative license there. It's fine. I think Marco's explanation of why he gave money is probably why a lot of people gave money. It's like, because it is like a Kickstarter. It's like, you know, you pledge money, and if everything goes well, you will get charged for your money or whatever. And it probably will, because this is very popular. But it seems like a small amount. And just like a Kickstarter, you're like, I don't know if they'll ever ship this damn cooler, but I'm gonna it looks cool. So yeah, spoiler alert. So like, it's not a big deal. Like, if they never go anywhere, or if I fund it for a few months and it's not that good, whatever. But I think there is an appetite for an attempt to find a solution to the fix all of, you know, journalism finds itself in at this moment in transition between the old world of newspapers and the way that they were funded and the barriers to entry in this new world, where it's much easier for more people to publish. But it's much harder to find ways to fund content that isn't sort of lowest common denominator, because people go, what people want to read and what it would be most beneficial to society if people were to read are two very different things. And that is a, you know, the incentives are not aligned. If the only way you can get money is by attracting people to read things, you will inevitably end up giving people what they want, which is not always what they need, which is a paternalistic view that people hate. Like, oh, the people in the ivory tower are going to determine what I need to see. Why can't people just pick what they need to see? There's a balance. Like, I mean, even in the bad old days of my childhood, when there was no internet, there were things called tabloids that provided you same stuff that you can find on the internet now. It's not like that stuff is like, oh, that didn't exist before the internet. Of course it did. Like, you know, Bat Boy Found, the National Enquirer, like, you know, aliens are everywhere, right? That stuff has always and will always exist. And I'm not even sure if it's any more prevalent than it is today. The difference today is that the sort of slow motion decline of the ivory tower, we know what's best for you, we're going to apply a bunch of reasoning and rules that you don't know about or agree with to try to provide what we think is, you know, the news that's fit to print. And that has been in slow decline, mostly rightfully so, because it's kind of a concentration of power that is not, you know, that is artificial, you know, technological barriers to distribution of information causing it to exist. But I would also say that in this new world where it's easier to distribute information, a lot of people like Marco and me, and I would imagine Casey, are less satisfied with how things are going. Not that we want to go back to the old ways, because that was bad in a different set of ways, but that there are pathologies in the new structure of news that we wish we could get rid of. It's like, we all want to read really good, high quality, journalism, according to the system of journalism, I think, is something that most of us can agree upon, kind of like the scientific method. It's just the question of, it is, how is it executed by fallible humans, and how do we provide the resources for it to be executed? And that's what this thing is trying to provide. Now, my personal grudge against, disagreement with, indifference to Wikipedia as an institution, depending on how you want to phrase it, caused me to have a little snarky chuckle when I saw this Venn diagram here. It's like community journalists and facts right underneath Jimmy Wales. So I was like, oh, now you care about facts, Jimmy Wales. I thought it was just all about verifiability. Wait a second. And maybe they don't mean facts. Maybe they actually mean verifiability. But that's the thing about journalism. Journalism, like, they are pursuing the truth of what happened. It's not enough for a journalist to say, one thing is for reporters to say, let me just tell you what somebody said. But journalists try to uncover the truth. If they can find out what really happened by talking to more people and gathering evidence, that's part of journalism too. And the journalist is not going to call it a day when they have quotes from three prominent people about what happened. The journalist would like to know, yeah, but what really happened? Right. I know these quotes are verifiable. I know you said this at this time and this other paper published this thing. But what really happened? What are the facts? And that is an important part of journalism. That is not an important part of Wikipedia, because Wikipedia doesn't care what the hell the facts are, because that's not what it is. It's a tertiary source. I don't want to go off on all my rants about Wikipedia again. So it's kind of exciting to see this taking a different slant on things. But as I scroll down through their plan and see like journalists and community cooperating, all I can think about is, like, this is like a battle arena for edit wars. It's like edit wars distilled. Because if you think there are edit wars on the Wikipedia page for, insert favorite controversial political figure, can you imagine what the edit wars will be like on literally any actual current event news story in the current political climate? Like, there's almost nothing you can put in there. Articles being, fact-checked and verified by journalists and community members working side by side as equals. And I just picture a giant arena with like people with boards with nails sticking out of them. Like, I'm not sure how it can work. And you can say, well, look at Wikipedia. It works.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the biggest example. Like, Wikipedia has the same issue. Any kind of, political topic also has a Wikipedia page. And they, they've built systems and policies and norms up around controlling that problem there too. And so, I think if anybody has shown that they have the ability to manage that part of this, it's the people who made Wikipedia and who built that whole community up. So that, I think, I'm actually not concerned about the whole edit war problem.
Don't you think Wikipedia is a counterexample? Because the fact that so many pages on Wikipedia are incredibly locked down because of the edit wars, almost to the point where they become frozen in time, which is kind of okay for historical things, but for pages that are ongoing, they become the sole domain of a very small number of people who have even the ability to edit page, and everybody else is completely locked out, and yet still they have edit wars and arguments about what goes on. Like, you can't do journalism in that environment. I feel like the controversial pages on Wikipedia are A, not the best source for information on their topics, and B, do a terrible job of staying up to date, and C, do not allow the input from the community, because they have to be walled off. They have to be cemented, set in stone, guarded night and day, incredibly protected. They become ossified. I think the best pages on Wikipedia are the pages that few people care about. Which, the classic example of being like lists of Pokemon and stuff, right? Because
a lot of people care.
No one, well, maybe there are edit wars in Pokemon. Sorry if I'm picking, but pages that are on more obscure topics, because the only people who edit and contribute to them are the people who really are interested in the topic. No one cares enough to vandalize it or edit them, and no one is there telling them what they can and can't add, and especially if they don't have any kind of political or factional angle. Again, Pokemon may not be a great example. They end up being filled with all sorts of interesting and useful information. Whereas the stories in any topic that has any part of it that's controversial, you're better off just scrolling to the bottom, looking at all the references and reading all those than actually reading the Wikipedia page. So, I get what you're saying about they have systems in place, but I think the systems negate the advantages they're trying to do, which is fine for Wikipedia because every page on Wikipedia is not a super duper controversial page. In fact, very few of them are. So the vast majority of Wikipedia is awesome when you just want to get a quick plot synopsis of a particular episode of Doctor Who in a particular season. That's on Wikipedia, and you'll find it quickly, and the webpage won't be gross or filled with ads, and it's a reliable source for that, because no one cares enough about to screw with it, or as reliable as any source could be. But when you go to any page having to do with any controversial topic, I feel like when's the last time you read a Wikipedia page on a controversial topic? Like, I don't even bother going to them anymore. Like, I would, again, rather just scroll right down to the references and read the, you know, primary and secondary sources than this tertiary summary, because it doesn't speak to me as a great source of information.
Well, I mean, keep in mind that, you know, these days every fact is a controversial topic, even the most basic things that you would think wouldn't be. And also that, you know, Wiki Tribune is I think, largely probably not going to have this problem, because it's probably not going to be that big of a deal. If it does become a big deal, if it does actually start attracting large amounts of traffic, then I think it will rise to the levels of, you know, these kinds of challenges that Wikipedia has, because Wikipedia has been, you know, such a massive, you know, traffic getter for so long. So, you know, it's ranked so well everywhere. But, like, Wiki Tribune is starting from zero. It's starting from no audience, basically. So it might be a while before there's even enough people to matter. And honestly, I disagree with you. I think Wikipedia is as good as something like this could be about dealing with controversial things like that. You know, it's a hard problem, but it
depends on the controversy. I mean, the main controversy having to do with Wikipedia controversial pages is the idea that the people who hold the keys to power to the controversial pages themselves tend to be homogenous and have various biases, let's say. Right?
Yeah, that's
and
a problem.
That the system itself has no way to deal with that. Like, that it concentrates power. Like, I'm thinking of Wiki Tribune as perhaps an unintentional backdoor way to get people to just straight up pay for news, which many people, the front doorway has been like, hey, sign up for the New York Times Digital. Like, can we make money from people paying us to read our web pages? Everyone's been trying to do that, and it's really difficult, the whole paywall thing, right? Wiki Tribune is like, we're open and free to everybody, man. Fast forward 5 years if they get super popular and they lock everything down, and eventually it's like, wait a second, this is just a newspaper where professional journals do things and people pay them. And it's not a giant community published thing. It is like a bunch of articles that nobody can edit, because every single story about the president is super duper controversial, and every one of them is super locked down, and the only people who get edited are the professional journalists who get money from the contributors, and the five people who all happen to be the same type of person with the same type of background who has the time and inclination to spend all day on Wiki Tribune. And now it is just a weirdly organized newspaper that people pay for, which wouldn't be the end of the world, because, again, that's things that people have been looking for. Hey, can we get people to pay money to support news, like, as opposed to wanting everything for free and wanting every article to be, a clickbaity, tabloidy, celebrity news kind of thing? I guess if they do that, then they're kind of a success, but I have a hard time envisioning a future where they are wildly successful and yet still even open to the degree that Wikipedia is open. Because unlike Wikipedia, pretty much everything a news organization will report will attract factions. Like you said, Marco, they could report on the weather and people will leave nasty comments about, you know, climate denial and stuff. You know, like, I can't think of a top. There's not even a human interest story. You try to put something about dogs and people won't like it. Like, nothing is safe in this climate. So they have their work cut out for them. But all this said, not that I feel like I'm slamming a Wiki Tribune on the potential of what it could be, I didn't donate any money, but I wish them well, because I also, like Marco, want somebody to address this problem. And no one has tried this approach. No one of this caliber has tried this approach. So we're not going to find out if it works unless somebody does it. And so I'm like, all right, you know, go for it. Like, I certainly, the fact that facts with a little arrow is a big circle in the middle makes me happy. By all means, go for that. The other aspect of this is, say they succeed in producing what they say they're going to produce, and their system produces good content, do people read it?
I would guess.
Like, is that something people want to do? I want to go to Wiki Tribune because they got their facts straight?
I mean, everyone wants a nonpartisan news source, right?
No, so, they don't. No, everyone wants to hear their own biases reflected to them and reinforced.
Okay, fair,
that's what people
fair,
want.
Fair.
Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, how did they get people to come and read this? Like, it was easier when you only had a few choices, and all of those choices had, you know, had systems in place that constrained what could be talked about. which perpetuated, you know, tons of systems of power in terms of whose stories got to get told with what angle on them. So it was terrible in many, many ways. But the good aspects of it were in the areas where the system wasn't completely aligned against hearing about things that, you know, that we weren't supposed to hear about. There was an expectation that, for example, the news department and advertising were separated from each other in some way. Like, that was part of the principles that they worked based on. And that only works if the news department isn't responsible for bringing in more money year after year after year. And that ship has long sailed. So now it's like, got to make more money, got to get more viewers. How do we do that? Tell them what they want to hear. And the cycle just goes around and around. That's what this is trying to resolve. So say it resolves it and they make real quality news, but no one ever comes and reads it. Are they still a success?
Maybe. I don't know. I really think this could be very popular because I think somebody like the two of you guys and myself, somebody like us, who wants to be informed but wants a very level-headed take as to what's going on, I think this is a potentially, maybe not perfect, but really great answer to that need. I agree with you that I shouldn't have said everyone wants this because a lot of people probably don't want this. But I also think there's a lot of people that do want this, that do want a level-headed take on things. That's why, for example, in my RSS reader that I rarely look at anymore, my source of news is the BBC. Because I have the BBC's U.S. coverage, and I feel like that is the least politically motivated news source that I can find. I don't need to hear of better ones. I don't really care if the BBC isn't perfect. I'm not trying to start a fight here.
Well, they're just reinforcing your biases. That's why you like them.
It could be. It very well could be.
That's the situation I think we find ourselves in.
Wait. What if your biases are true and facts?
Well, see, yeah. Anyway, the idea, here's the problem with polarized marketplace is that, you know, things don't exist in isolation. Say there was a news source that did a really good job of executing journalism, classic journalism, the rules of journalism, which, you know, like the traditional rules of journalism in terms of what you're supposed to do as a reporter and what your job is and isn't, all separate from, you know, editorial and opinion, which is a whole separate thing, but just like the plain straight-up journalism reporting thing. There's still an editorial function deciding what should and shouldn't you cover, how many stories in topic A, how many stories in topic B, how many stories about this aspect of whatever. Like, it's impossible to ever pull yourself entirely away from that. And it's also impossible to think about what your publication is doing in isolation. You exist as a publication in an ecosystem with tons of other publications. And a lot of the ecosystem is defined by how many people read or, you know, watch or whatever, consume these different publications. And in that environment, that's why you see a lot of, like, you know, people on our side of the world, liberals or whatever, being drawn to liberal-leaning publications because they see it as the only possible way to counterbalance the things leaning in the other direction, because we know those things that lean in the other direction exist. We know, we all think they're terrible, and we know tons and tons of people use them as their exclusive source of news. And so by providing it a neutral thing, it's like, well, that's all well and good if we just want to know what's happening. But if we want to balance the scales, and that we have to have a left-leaning publication, and eventually you're like, I want to read the left-leaning thing, because all I hear all day from, you know, people who I disagree with is them citing their super duper right leaning things. And so don't we, and that's how you end up with polarization, super duper left leaning, super duper right leaning. And so I don't feel like I want that. I tried to find something that I think is in the middle. But like Casey with the BBC, I'm sure what I think is in the middle is not actually in the middle. And really what I'm seeking is it's not in the execution of the journalism, but in the choice of what they're reporting about. Right. Or in the choice of, like, you know, what the editorials are about and how they apportion their coverage, because that in itself is a political stance, right? So when I read the Washington Post, I feel like here's good reporting. Here they're still executing journalism according to the old ways. But what the Washington Post decides to cover is decidedly left leaning in terms of the number of stories on topic A, B, C, and D, right? And I'm okay with that, but I would still, you know, and I would still say the Washington Post and even the New York Times are examples of good executions of classic journalism. But I would also agree that both of them are quote unquote left leaning, as compared to the choices of things and headlines that the right-leaning publications choose to cover. And they're a counterbalance, right? So if there was something that was really straight up the middle, I'm not sure that would be doing much of a service, because especially if the polarized ends continue to be what they are, unless everybody at the ends kind of agrees, like the Wicked Tribune is like the tiebreaker, right? And as Marco pointed out before, and we'll keep going back to, that is impossible in a world where we can't agree on the facts. There is no, it's like, well, we have the, you know, this left-leaning editorial selection, and we have this right-leaning editorial selection, but we all agree that the facts are what are on WikiTribune, right? And be like, no, the right will say, we don't agree on facts at all. And so what function is WikiTribune even serving there? Unless it starts getting cited by other newspapers, which would be funny, but we'll see.
I mean, at this point, there are people actually arguing whether to let people die in our country who were sick once because they don't have enough money and they should therefore die. That is literally what we are arguing about.
I liked it better in the 80s when they had like sophisticated ideological arguments, but they've abandoned those now. It's just like, why should you get to live? It's like, good point there, evil person. Why should I get to live? What right do I have to life or liberty or any kind of, looking for happiness? That sounds crazy to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was your fault that you got, sick when you were a teenager or something. So therefore, the penalty for that should obviously be death, right?
Why don't you try living right, Marco? You ever think of that?
Yeah, right. I mean, look, yeah. we all did it, right? Why can't you? Oh my God.
Yeah, the Jimmy Kimmel's son. Did you guys watch that monologue?
Oh,
like
I couldn't.
A few days ago?
I heard enough about it that I couldn't watch it.
No, I saw it fly by. I've been doing a Couch to 5K lately, and during one of the walking parts, I was like, cruising through Twitter as I was power walking, probably looking like a moron. But be that as it may, whatever day it was, this popped in the morning onto my my world, and I watched it or listened to it. I should say I didn't watch any of it, but I listened to it as I was like going between walking and running, and basically I was on the verge of bawling the entire time. But if you're one of those monsters that thinks that a pre-existing condition is something that just that's enough to disqualify you, that's cool. You should read or you should listen to this story about Jimmy Kimmel's son, who was born with a terrible heart defect. And were it not for some of the protections, we shouldn't be getting this political, but here we are without some of these protections.
It's important, as we've talked about, like certain times, politics or other world events do bleed into relevance to all people. And I think this is one of those times. Like, this is a topic that is, among many things, so politicized, more than I think it probably should be. And I think a lot of that is intentionally artificial to hide the things that the politicians really want to get accomplished, which mostly have to do with money for themselves and their class of people and their associates and lobbyists and everything else. So there's lots of that stuff going on in the background here. And we're arguing about, whether people who have not been as lucky as some of us should go bankrupt and die because of that. And that is unconscionable.
Yeah. So anyway, so this Jimmy Kimmel thing, it's a little under 15 minutes. It's worth every second, in my personal opinion. And like I said, I was on the verge of bawling the entire time I listened to it. But the short version is his son had a terrible heart defect. He is now fine. And if some of the changes to American healthcare that have been proposed pass, then his son would never be able to have health insurance for the rest of his life because he was born with a problem with his heart. So, yeah, I guess his son should have been living in the womb better and made better choices in utero, and then he wouldn't have this problem, right? That's how this works?
Yeah, maybe he listened to too much heavy metal music. Who knows? I mean, and the thing, like, this isn't... It's not like this is a theoretical. It's not like, we think people will go bankrupt and die because of this. No, we know, because that's how it was before the ACA. A lot of people went bankrupt and died. This is not a small thing. This is not an unknown. It's very much known. We were there. It was horrible. We tried to fix it as best as we could, and it wasn't perfect. But the right fix is not to go back to that. We've seen it already. We've tried that. I don't know why this is even possibly a point of contention. Well, I do know why, really, but it's not a good reason.
Yeah. And one of the things that was fascinating by about having this tweet that that I'd sent in January about the Affordable Care Act, which we'll link all this in the show notes. But one of the fascinating things about having a tweet that gets retweeted 16,000 times is that everyone and their mother comes and tells you about why you're right, why you're wrong. And the tweet that I had tweeted read, "Opposition I've heard to the Affordable Care Act. Number one, it costs me money. Number two, it's not perfect. Support for the Affordable that I've heard for the Affordable Care Act. Number one, I would have died without the coverage guaranteed," which is what we're talking about. And man, so many people came out of the woodwork and were like, "No, you don't get it. It's about this. It's about that." One person had said, I forget how he phrased it, but it was something along the lines of, "I shouldn't have to pay for people who eat McDonald's all the time to deal with their diabetes." I was like, okay, I live a healthy life. I shouldn't have to pay for all these unhealthy people. Well, aren't you a winner? But anyway, after just hundreds of stories about the Affordable Care Act and why it's great and why it's terrible, the only good, or in my estimation anyway, the only good answer I heard about why the Affordable Care Act was bad was that some people said, well, I make enough that I'm priced out of all the subsidy tiers, and I'm way oversimplifying here, but I make enough money that I'm priced out of all the like super cheap tiers, but I don't really make enough to afford like the whatever the opposite scenario was. I forget what it is, but basically they were in this like negative, this really terrible middle of the road. Here's an example. This is somebody that tweeted, "I pay more than I can afford for insurance with a deductible too high to matter." That's pretty crummy, and that should get fixed. But everything else was like just people who basically are looking for their fellow man to die because they didn't want to pay for them to live. And that's just, I don't understand how this is a question. How is this a question right now? I don't get it.
That's the thing, is like there's, you know, that sentiment of like, why should I pay for the people who, you know, are unhealthy? Like, that is such a toxic way to think, because like, okay, well, let's follow that through. If that's what you think, that you shouldn't have to pay for people who are, you know, who do things that you don't like or whatever, and that makes them unhealthy, even though a lot of times they can't help what has made them unhealthy. But anyway, suppose you don't want to pay for it. Okay, what should the penalty be for someone who does this thing you don't like, who can't afford it? Is that punishable by death? Is that an appropriate, you know, penalty? Like, literally, like, that's like, is that your actual position? Like, if that's what you think,
don't ask questions you don't want the answers to, because they would say, yes, of course, they're getting what they deserve. That's exactly what they say.
Right. I mean, if these people actually think that way, I think they should own that. I think they should come right out and say, yes, I think all these people who can't afford their health care should die. Like, if that's what they think, let's bring that discussion. Let's see how that discussion goes in the open. Now,
we have people in Congress owning that at this point.
That's true.
I don't think that's a position people are shrinking from.
And the thing is, like, you can apply that kind of thinking, you know, why should I have to pay for that, to everything that government provides. Like, that's kind of the whole nature of government. Like, it provides a bunch of services with people's tax money, most of which, you know, like, any given person probably doesn't directly use a lot of these services, but they also benefit from lots of other ones, and it's a different pool for each person, you know, and that's the role of government. Like, why should I pay for a giant military that starts wars I don't want? Well, that's just part of the government. Like, it's part of our system. We vote for things, and you know, this is what happens. And sometimes our votes even are counted properly and equally. And I just this is so toxic. And I wish I knew what it was that made people so hateful of everybody else. Really, like, maybe it's just because everyone else listens to way less Fish than I do. But I just cannot possibly understand what it is that makes someone think to themselves, "Oh, those people don't deserve to live." Like, I don't get that at all, and that makes me really sad that is such a prevalent attitude.
That's what I was saying. Harken back to the days of the 80s when it was commonly accepted that the goal was to make people healthier. And the only argument was about how best to do that. The free market can do it. No, the government can do it. No, the government is inefficient and bloated, and we will have a better system if we allow competition, and blah, 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 blah. Like, that was the level of the argument that was going on, right? And these days, that is not, like, the level of the argument. The accepted premises of trying to get everybody as healthy as possible, like, people barely on the right give, you know, barely make feints in that direction. Like, they're not even interested in saying, "You don't understand. This way people will actually be healthier. Fewer people will die. Like, everyone will, you know, they'll say that at the broad level, but they will not actually show how the numbers add up. They will not show their math. They will not say, look, here's what we say. Even if it's just BS predictions, BS sort of trickle-downy predictions, if we allow this to happen and this competition happens here and there, what's going to happen? Let me show you my BS model with BS predictions. They don't even do that. They're like, we don't need to do that. We just wave our hands and you know, pit one person against the other and do what it takes to get this passed. And then we end up with what we end up with. I miss the pretend intellectual debates, is what I'm saying.
I don't get it. It just makes me so sad. Like, I don't understand how any intelligent human being with three brain cells to rub together can think that the Affordable Care Act is bad. I just don't get it. Like, it's not perfect.
No, it is bad. I mean, it's should we move to something worse? I'm going to say no, we shouldn't do that.
Right. It's the whole, like, you know, perfect enemy of the good thing. Like, you know, healthcare is a hard problem. It's really expensive to provide healthcare for people. That has to be paid for somehow, whether you're, you know, whether it's people paying themselves or whether it's government single payer kind of things or some kind of weird thing in between like what we have now. Like, it's just, it's a hard problem. It's a really hard problem. But that, you know, the ACA took this really hard problem that was really in a bad state before and made it less bad. And yeah, the cost went up. We're all paying more now for worse coverage. But that was happening anyway. Anybody who was actually paying for their coverage before the ACA saw that trend already. In fact, with the ACA, I'm still now paying less than what I paid the year before the ACA went into effect. And the coverage isn't as good, but I'm actually still netting less per year in expenditure for it. And also, I'm way less worried about hitting some crazy limit or, you know, like a lifetime limit or pre-existing conditions all of a sudden excluding everyone from everything. Like, this is a better system, and it still sucks. And that's why people are so mad, because it is still really expensive and coverage still does really suck. And we all have high deductibles now, and we all have, like, having to go through crappy mail order pharmacies for our prescriptions. But that was happening before. Whatever the Republicans get through, whatever they do to this, I guarantee you, your coverage is still going to be really expensive, and you're still going to have to deal with BS from mail order pharmacies and having to fill all these different referrals and everything else. That's all going to still be there, and your costs are going to go up the year after that and the year after that and every year after that. Your costs are going to keep going up and up and up. This, whatever they pass, is not going to solve that. It can't. All they're trying to do is go back to the way it was before the ACA, which sucked. And yeah, the ACA sucked, but that sucked way more before. And that's what they want to go back to. It is really hard to talk about this because literally thousands of additional people will die every year because of this. Like, this is not a small thing. This isn't just like, oh, I'll have an extra $200 a month. It's just like, no, thousands of people will die. And, like, you know, you look at things that change in our country, policies, laws, liberties that changed in our country as a result of, say, September 11th. Lots of things changed because of that. And then if you look at, like, how many people are dying unnecessarily because of not having proper health care, it is such a massive problem, and so many people go bankrupt or die or both unnecessarily. It is unconscionable to me that we still continue to try to go back to the way it was, because it was worse. And again, I know why people are so mad at the ACA, because they see those bills coming in every month for the healthcare, and they, oh yeah, my premium keeps going up, my coverage keeps getting worse. Yeah, but that was happening before. This made it a little bit less crappy for everybody, and now we're going to go back to that. It's awful.
It's a cut off your nose and spite to spite your face situation, and after tomorrow, you won't be able to get your nose put back on. And then it'll be a pre-existing condition if you try to switch coverage. So you're just screwed the whole way down.
Mm-hmm.
But don't worry, guys. At least the figurehead of the new system won't be a black guy, so it's all good now.
Yeah. Or a woman. Heaven forbid. We are sponsored this week by Indochino. Custom-made suits made exactly to your measurements that'll fit you better than any off-the-rack suits ever could. Indochino has made it easy to get a perfectly tailored suit at an incredible price. Everybody looks better in clothes that fit them nicely, and Indochino's suits will be custom made for your measurements, so they will fit you better, they will make you feel better than pretty much anything else you can get anywhere else. Indochino has made this easy by they let you choose from hundreds of top quality fabrics. You can personalize your suit to just the way you want it, whether it's for work or a wedding or another special occasion. They have suited up hundreds of thousands of people. They are the largest made-to-measure menswear brand in the world. So here's what you do. You go to Indochino.com. You take your measurements, and they make this incredibly easy. They have these great videos that show you exactly how to measure yourself. You type in each measurement as you go. It's nice and easy. You submit these to them, and then you choose your fabric, any kind of customizations you want, from lapels to pleats to linings and lots more stuff. Then you place your order and wait for it to arrive in just a few weeks. It's that easy. This week, listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389. $389 with our code ATP at checkout to get any premium suit custom made for you at Indochino. That's 50% off the regular price. Once again, go to Indochino.com, promo code ATP to get any premium suit for just $389 with free shipping also. It's an incredible deal for a suit that will fit you better than anything off the rack ever could. Thank you very much to Indochino for sponsoring our show.
Amazon releases the Echo Look. Here again, I don't know a lot about it, except in this case, it's because I really don't care. But apparently it's an Echo with a camera that will tell you if you look good or not, or something along those lines. So what's going on here, and are we enthusiastic about it?
John, you getting one?
I don't think I'm going to get one of these, but I actually am. I'm not going to say I'm enthusiastic about it, but I think what it is doing is a natural thing to do, and I think we're going to see more of it, not less. Like, in the same way that I was strangely, or at least not uniquely, but it was, I think I had more enthusiasm for the Amazon Echo when they first showed that little ad with the cylinder. More optimism, let's say, that this could potentially be a cool, useful thing. Then most people who saw it, because they were like, this looks dumb, it's never going to work. And I had the same kind of, this looks dumb and it's not going to work as well as they show it working reaction too. But I was also kind of like, this class of device seems like it could be a thing. And now I see this, which is like essentially a little camera. So imagine combining with an Echo with a camera. It's a camera that you can talk to that has some awareness of who and where you are, and it has some specific functionality having to do with fashion and Amazon trying to sell you clothes and yada yada. Like, I don't think the details matter that much, except that this is like, because it's Amazon and because they have the pedigree of the Echo, that this product, and because they're going to push it like crazy on their website, that this product has as good a chance as any to be the first product to get any kind of traction in this category. And the category is simply a computer that you can talk to that also can see you, right? The Amazon Echo and the Dot and Google Home and all those things are like a computer that you can talk to. A computer that you can talk to that can also see you, natural evolution. The number of things that you can do with that ability, with all of our even just current technology for like facial recognition and identifying things in scenes and Kinect Xbox style understanding gestures and your position, the position of your body and stuff like that. That is a rich vein of interaction with computing devices that we should begin to tap. And if it has to be a weird fashion camera that spies on you and uploads pictures of you to Amazon to sell you more clothes, I mean, the cylinder ended up being an Amazon thing to let you buy paper towels by talking to it. Like, things come in weird packages, right? Like, I mean, I suppose it beats the old way, which is everything had to be attached to porn in some way to get any traction, although this potentially could be as well. But I am enthusiastic about the future of devices that are computers that can hear and see you. And so I think there needs to be more of these things, and they need to get better, and they will be cool and make our lives better, provided we can avoid all the pitfalls that, which is basically all people are talking about, the Echo, all the privacy and security and, you know, just general creepiness implications. But I think the foundation is sound, so I wish them some success, and I hope they learn from it and branch out.
I'm just now watching the video quickly, and with no audio, I'm just looking at the video as you're talking, and I think I would have noticed, but certainly it was called out in one of the podcasts I listened to this week, that there isn't a man in this video until like the last 10 seconds, which is actually pretty cool that they're, you know, pitching this directly at women. And I think it stands to reason that your average woman would be more enthusiastic about this than your average man. Obviously, that's not a universal truth, but I think that's kind of cool. And I personally am not in love, partially because I haven't really lived it. I'm not in love with the idea of an Echo in general, let alone an Echo with eyes. But again, just because I'm not really gaga for it doesn't mean it's not a good idea and not a good device. It's just it's not something that I feel like I need right now. Marco.
So first of all, there was a great discussion about this, especially by Lisa Schmeiser, who knows a lot about retail, on the first episode of the new Relay podcast called Download. This is like Jason Snell's kind of new hosted show, almost like an expanded Clockwise, but more broad and even more produced and like even more wide audience. I'm guessing over time this might become the biggest show on Relay and one of the biggest tech shows, period. So I would suggest getting on the ground floor and going to subscribe to Download now at relay.fm/download. Anyway, they didn't pay me or even ask me to say that, but I think you should because it's really good. Anyway, great discussion on episode one by Alicia Schmeiser, especially about this from the retail point of view, from a lot of good knowledge that we don't personally have, but I greatly enjoyed. Anyway, I'm with you. You know, obviously, this is being marketed heavily towards women, and it's hard for me to fully understand it as both a man and also a man who doesn't care at all about his own personal fashion. And so it's
except on your wrist.
Except on my wrist. I care very much about that, but I don't need a camera to tell me which watch to wear every day. I just put on the one that I feel like wearing, and I enjoy it. But, you know, that's... If there was one that took a wrist shot for me every day and compare, you know, like, and gave me like a wrist book of shots of how I looked over time, maybe that might do something interesting. I don't know. Bottom line, this isn't for me, and so I don't want to try to. I don't want to make large proclamations about it either way, because it's fundamentally a product I don't understand. And this was made very clear to me by the reactions on Twitter when this was announced. It was extraordinarily polarized. Tech dudes like us largely made fun of it and said, why would anybody want to buy this? Oh my God, Amazon is nuts. And a lot of people who were not tech dudes, who, you know, I would venture to guess that most of us, myself included, probably wear a basic, you know, t-shirt every day that we don't have to wear something for work. You know, t-shirt and jeans, maybe. That's kind of the uniform of tech. A hoodie, if it's cool, or if you live in San Francisco. You know, that's kind of the uniform of, like, tech geeks. So all of us looked at this and said, this is crazy. Why would we let Amazon put a camera in our bedroom to do this thing we don't care about? But people who were really into clothing and fashion really enjoyed this. The reaction from most of them, and this wasn't all women, I should say. I'm very carefully, you know, trying to dance around the women angle here, because I don't want to be sexist, but it is very clear that this is how this is being targeted. And I did see very different reactions from most women compared to most men in my timeline. But I really don't want to say anything more than that, because I don't know what I'm talking about. It is not at all for me, but I think this will probably succeed. You know, when the original Echo Cylinder first came out, we all made fun of it. Because first of all, the way it was presented, the video it was presented in was awful. I mean, it was comically bad, and it was pretty soon after the Fire Phone, and so we were pretty sure, like, yeah, Amazon really is nuts with their hardware. Like, they don't know what they're doing. It did indeed sound crazy that you're going to put a microphone in your house that listens all the time and is owned by Amazon. Really, but then it only takes like one friend to get it. And for you to be at their house for a little while, and you know, with them using it to kind of see, like, oh, actually, that's pretty cool. And so it is the kind of thing where, like, it does sound kind of ridiculous up front, but it might succeed anyway. And I think all you need to know whether it will succeed or not is, like, is there any group of people right now, right up front, who are saying, oh my God, yes, give me that right now? And the answer, from what I can see, is yes. My wife wants one. I know a bunch of other people on Twitter who said they wanted one. Like, again, it isn't for everyone, but it is probably definitely for some people. And so even though it seems creepy, you know, to me as a nerd, it's going to be a thing. And I think I would not discount Amazon in this. I would not assume they're crazy. I will occasionally make funny tweets about it, but I do think they're probably going to sell this. And it's probably going to become part of a bigger thing. And it's probably going to have its own little weird oddities, just like every Amazon product always does. But I think it'll work long term.
I don't think you need to have any weird speculation and say like, oh, this will be for some people. Because like it is so right down the middle of things that we know people already like to do in massive numbers. People like to take pictures of themselves. The word selfie is known to far and wide for a very good reason. If you look at how people use social media and how many times they're taking pictures of themselves or what they're wearing, very often on a regular basis, right? This is merely an automation of that in the same way that the Amazon Echo is an automation of all the things you have other ways to do. Like, this is not speculative that people might want to take pictures of themselves or their outfits, right? This is just, you know, so there's so clearly a market need. The only question is, does this product automate it in a way that actually makes it easier to do a thing that we know people want to do? We know they want to do it. They do it like crazy now manually the hard way. Having something that's, you know, this is, again, as the first application of a computer that can also see you, right? Having something that can do that with the smarts that we have developed for cameras to find where the heck you are and, you know, take good pictures of you. It is easier for a computer to do that than to you to try to do it yourself with a mirror or holding out your phone or doing other sorts of stuff like that, especially if it becomes in the same way that the Echo does. Like, this becomes so easy, it just becomes part of my routine, right? The people who meticulously catalog their outfits each day that they're proud of their outfits, that is a big effort that most people don't want to go through. But it's like Marco said, if Marco didn't have to think about it, but just went through his day and put on his watch, and at some point, some point 20 years in the future, when, you know, his grandchildren are visiting in his super duper fancy smart home, he just wakes up in the morning, picks out what watch he wants to wear, puts it on, and then at the end of the month can view beautiful in focus close up shots of every watch he wore on every day. How did those pictures happen? Because the cameras that are all over his house invisibly can always find him and take these amazing photographs in low light, perfect focus, and he doesn't have to pose for them, and he doesn't have to do anything. In the same way that the magic checkout counter, you know, barcode scanner, just you bring the food by and you kind of twirl it and you know, spin it by the little scanner and the little lasers will find it, right? In that same type of technology, if you had a bunch of smart cameras in your house that eventually will be so cheap and so good that they will be able to do this without you having to stand in a certain place or do a certain thing. That is the future that, you know, that is coming to. The questions about it are all legit questions in terms of who owns this data. Is it okay for Amazon, for us to upload it to Amazon and for them to keep it forever? And how is this funded? If the hardware isn't profitable itself, is entirely funded about it as a way to sell us, you know, clothes or whatever. And what are the security implications and how hackable are these? All these are going to be, there's going to be terrible disasters in all these areas, but there is no denying that the amount of computery things in our house will only increase with time, and that it is kind of a ratcheting mechanism, and that this first one aiming to be a mechanization of a thing that we know people already love to do is very smart and builds on their Echo stuff. As for the things I talk about in terms of technology and privacy, I think Amazon is probably terrible in them. I think their security is probably crap. I think their privacy policy is probably terrible. I think if they're hacked, people are going to get tons of data and people will regret getting these things if that ever happens. If it doesn't, Amazon gets lucky. If it does, we will all just regret it together as people have a giant archive of photographs and audio of you over many, many years that use Amazon devices. But even Marco, famously paranoid, is willing to take that trade because they do make his life better enough that he's, you know, that he's willing to take that risk. And most people are not as paranoid as Marco and won't think twice about this if it actually delivers on what it is intending to do.
We are sponsored this week by Betterment, investing made better. Go to betterment.com/ATP to learn more. Betterment is a smarter way to invest your money by providing investing advice through smart technology, automated investing, and human advisors. They have changed the industry by using the same strategy that financial advisors use with clients who have millions of dollars. But now they're available to everyone, including smart rebalancing, global diversification, tax-efficient strategies, and more. Because Betterment's mission is to help you manage and grow your investments to build your financial future, but all with low fees. So you lose less of your money along the way. Because if you do the math, typical investment fees and costs really add up over time, and Betterment's fees are a fraction of the cost of other financial services. And Betterment's so easy to use that they've won awards for their customer experience. When have you ever heard that about a financial institution before? I never have before. You can log into a demo account right from the website if you're curious to see for yourself. Now, for a limited time offer, sign up for Betterment, and you may qualify for a free Canary home security system to help secure your home. That sounds pretty cool. So anyway, terms and conditions do apply, and investing involves risk. To learn more, visit Betterment.com/ATP. That's Betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, investing made better.
Okay, so in the last, 24, 48 hours as we record, Microsoft has released basically a Surface Book Air. They've taken what basically all of us wanted from the new MacBook Air that we have yet to receive and made a Surface laptop out of it.
I love that you assume that a new MacBook Air is something that is coming. It just isn't here yet.
Fair. But the thing that we all wanted, which would effectively be a new Retina MacBook Air with better internals and better ports and whatnot, Microsoft seems to have just released it. So I think they're pre-ordering soon, if memory serves. As we record, I don't believe it's available for purchase. But the very little bit that I've looked into it, it looked really nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting, first of all, that the Microsoft Surface branding was originally for, well, first it was for the giant table, then it went away for a few years, and then it came back as this, like, you know, consumer, you know, convertible laptop tablet thing, and then it slowly became like closer to regular computers, and now they're just like, all right, screw it, here's just a laptop, and we're gonna call it the Surface laptop. And it's like they did all these crazy things, and they could kind of slowly work their way back to what most people actually want in their computer, which is a traditional style laptop. And it does have a touchscreen, so bonus points for that. I do want to also point out, like, we Apple people, you know, we keep following the company line of, like, you know, no, we shouldn't have touchscreens on computers. Nobody wants that. But meanwhile, touchscreens have become very prevalent on PCs, and most people who use them seem to kind of like them. Like, people seem, you know, they might not use them all the time, or they might not use them for a lot of things, but people who use them seem to enjoy them. Yep. Largely.
Yep,
so
completely agree.
So I do think that is something that should not be totally discounted as a thing. And maybe Apple's right, but they're sure do seem like a lot of people are using them. But I also think it's interesting that, you know, when the original, you know, Surface, not the table, but like the very first, like, weirdo, bizarre tablet laptop thing, when that first came out, it really seemed like this really, like, you know, niche, low volume, low selling device. But over time, Microsoft has been persistent and has just kept iterating and iterating. And now Surfaces are actually pretty common. Like, I see them out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I just don't recognize most other PC hardware. So, like, I don't like visually, like, notice it or count it. And whenever like people on Twitter do, like, coffee shop surveys, like Gruber likes to do sometimes, or, like, you know, I see some other people doing it, where, like, I'm like, all right, number of, like, you know, MacBooks in this coffee shop, 10, and number of, you know, Surfaces, 3, number of iPads, 2, you know, stuff like that. Surfaces tend to be represented pretty well, just, like, anecdotally out in the world. There seem to be a lot of them in coffee shops and in airports and on planes and stuff like that, and, like, on commuter trains, stuff like that. Like, so I do think that it is worth, I hope Apple is noticing, and they probably are, they're smart over there, I hope they are noticing that, like, these experiments that Microsoft has been doing with the Surface over time seemed outlandish at first. Not only are they getting less outlandish over time, as we all realize that some of those things are good ideas, but also they're getting pretty popular. And so I think that is something that we should not be ruling out. And, you know, some things are popular that are terrible. I mean, Dave Matthews Band, right? But their popularity, I think, should not be overlooked. And we should not assume that everything about the Surface and its line of products is Microsoft being weird and wacky, because a lot of it's sticking. So that is worth pointing out. So this particular computer, it looks pretty compelling for a lot of people. I mean, in a lot of ways, its specs are lower end than the MacBook Air. Although it is much newer, the MacBook Air still has, I think, like, 3 generations old now, parts, something like that. And this, I believe, the Microsoft Surface laptop is Kaby Lake, so it's, like, really current. If the MacBook Air had Skylake or Kaby Lake, it would get way better battery life. And it's already amazing, which means they could do some pretty cool things. But they're not. But they made the MacBook Pro instead, and we'll talk about that in a minute, like the Escape. But this laptop looks really good, because when the MacBook Air first came out, it was like the specialized thing. But over a pretty short time, it pretty quickly became like the mainstream laptop to have. And now it's the low-end laptop to have, but it's still, like, they still sell a ton of them, because the 13-inch MacBook Air, especially, like, that form factor, like, that combination, as I talked about before in the show, like, that's a really good sweet spot for a lot of people. It's an incredibly compelling overall package. There's a reason why everyone has MacBook Airs, and almost everyone who has them loves them. It's no coincidence that when Microsoft or when Apple introduced, well, that's quite a mistake. When Apple introduced the new MacBook Pros and kind of made it clear that the MacBook Air was on its way very slowly out, and that the new MacBook Air replacement was this 13-inch MacBook Escape that is more expensive and in some ways more limited. A lot of people were very upset about that. It's like no, you took this formula that we liked so much, and now you're telling us that it's over, and you're replacing it with something that's more expensive and more limited. So Microsoft comes along and says, all right, well, you know what? Here, this computer that you wanted, here, we just made it. We made like a up-to-date, basically, version of a Retina MacBook Air shaped and sized computer. And in most ways, it looks a lot like the MacBook Air. It, you know, again, like if you match it spec for spec, it is about the same price as the Air, and, although newer, and it is a few hundred dollars cheaper than the MacBook Escape for similar specs. Again, I think they're going to sell a lot of these. Now, they aren't the first PC maker to make a MacBook Air clone. You know, the PC makers have been making these for a while. Largely, I think one of the reasons why services have taken off so well is that PC hardware is largely total crap. Like, it is really bad. Like, the designs are crappy, like, and they're cheap plastic builds and just designs with very poor taste, you know? And Microsoft's designs have largely been pretty good. Like, for the Surface hardware, like, they've had a couple of, you know, weird little missteps here and there, but, you know, so is Apple. Like, no one's perfect. So Microsoft's actually, I think, doing pretty well here. And if I were buying a Windows PC for some reason, it would almost certainly be a Surface product of some kind, or I build my own if it was a desktop, probably. But like, if I was buying a PC laptop for some reason, I would almost certainly get one of these.
I agree with you. The thing is, I obviously my career prior to my current job was on the Microsoft stack, and so though I don't have any particular love for Microsoft in a nostalgic sense, I have admired the way they've really changed themselves. And really kind of adjusted the way they operate with Satya Nadella at the helm. And I think they've been doing a really good job and have been doing really fascinating stuff. For the San Franciscans, they pivoted. So anyway, the funny thing is, though, you can't really make Microsoft lose all of its old bits, because as I'm trying to get the URL for the Surface laptop to put in the show notes, I arrive at microsoftstore.com/store/msusa/enus/pdp/productid.510269110. Then, as I load that page, the page itself has been dimmed, and I have a modal. Don't miss out. Sign up to receive special deals, new offers, and more. No. The answer is no. So you can make Microsoft a lot better in general, but you can't ever really make Microsoft forget that they're Microsoft, can you?
Well, but what's the actual name of the MacBook Escape?
The MacBook Pro.
I believe it's the late 2013 13-inch MacBook Pro without touch bar.
Fair point, fair point, fair point.
With delete me in all caps at the end.
Yeah. So anyway, but no, I think this looks really great. I agree with you. If I were to buy a PC, it would either be a Lenovo or very, very likely a Surface laptop or something like this. I agree with you that everything I've heard from people who have touchscreen laptops, they swear by them. I think that seems really kooky, but it's probably one of those things that I just haven't tried it, and so I don't get it. And certainly for iOS simulator, that would be super helpful. So in that sense, I do get it. But I do like that there are different colors available. I don't recall what colors there are, but there's certainly several shades that you can get them in, which is really kind of stupid, but I like it. And I think that's kind of neat.
Apple sells, like, you know, the pink, gold, and dark gray 12-inch MacBook. Like, that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of color in your life, tech people. Like, that's fine. Color is nice.
Although here again, like, the marketing copy is preposterous. If you look at the bullets under Surface Laptop, luxurious Alcantara fabric covered keyboard is bullet number two. It's, come on. I mean, and Apple has their moments. Don't get me wrong. Apple is not innocent in this department, but luxurious Alcantara fabric covered keyboard, really, guys?
I'm glad you can't pronounce that word either, despite reading it in car magazines for the past several decades.
I thought it was Alcantara. I don't know.
You never have to say it out loud when it's in car magazines, and all of a sudden you're faced with this word. You got to do it a syllable at a time. Alcantara.
There we go.
Yeah, it's like Bazel. In any case, John, what do you think about this?
So the narrative for this is, like Marco said, Apple wouldn't make this laptop. This is the Retina MacBook Air that we have all wanted. But as Marco already pointed out, it's not like there haven't been a million PCs that are similar, that are like small, thin, use the MacBook Air class of processor, but are newer and have a Retina screen and so on and so forth. For this computer specifically, though, this is not the Retina MacBook Air that I would want, assuming it ran macOS. And not just because it's got a fuzzy top, which is kind of weird, and I think will get kind of gross. This, if Apple made this computer, I would right now be complaining about the ports and the RAM. 4 gigabytes RAM that you shouldn't even offer a computer with that much. It's stupid. Don't do that. And the ports, one big USB, one mini display port thingy, headphone, like no USB-C. That's not a modern computer. Like, I'm not saying you have to have all the ports in the world, but especially if you're going to be a PC, like, provide me utility. The utility that Apple won't add would be, you know, like what this thing has, except for USB-C instead of plain USB, maybe throw in one regular USB, because it's not like there's not room. Like, this is not a MacBook size super duper skinny thing. It's big enough that you could fit some more ports on there. And if I'm looking for anything in a PC, it's to do the port stuff that Apple won't do. So give me my ports. Put some USB-C on there. Put one regular USB. Put an SD card slot. Don't give me one big USB and one mini display port, and that's it. Like, I feel like it is RAM starve and port slim. And form factor wise, if I'm going to buy into the Surface brand, I know this is just like, this is a Surface laptop. Like, they do have a touch screen on it, but just like they do on the Surface Book and everything, but those can sort of transform into tablet-y things where all of a sudden the touch screen is much more viable. I'm not saying you don't want to have a touchscreen, because they should leverage the advantage they have, which is they have created an OS that is touch accessible, right? That's the whole thing that they've done. They have one combined OS that it is usable with your finger. You're not, you know, in theory, the interface that is on the screen has some chance of being used by your big, you know, 44-point in Apple parlance fingertip surface, right? And that's what they're telling people to make. Make an application that is usable in that way. We'll make controls and buttons and widgets and things that are usable in that way. macOS is not like that. So one of the advantages that that Microsoft has when it comes to directly competing against the Mac, not iOS, but the Mac, is that they have an interface that is available for touch. But touch on a plain old upright laptop screen like this, you're right, the PCs have been doing it forever. And you're right that people do like it because they can touch the screen. But I think Apple's also right that it is not a great experience. So I don't say there's a reason they shouldn't have put touch in here, but I wouldn't chalk it up as much of an advantage. It's more of a, well, we can do it anyway and we got to do it. But it makes me wish almost that this was a straight up laptop, but that the hinge went all the way around and you could just bend it back on itself. Right. You know, like the convertibles that they've made a million different varieties of. If it's not, I can get on board with them not disconnecting it, but if it's going to be a touchscreen, what if there is some application that I really want to use a touchscreen with? It is extremely awkward to use a very touch-centric interface when it's in a laptop configuration. So I put that down mostly as a neutral. And then so then I'm just like left with a laptop that is kind of middle of the road, kind of strange, not a good complement of ports, and the low-end model has terrible specs. So I'm not impressed with it as a laptop, but I do agree that Microsoft has been trying everything that you can conceivably try, and that they are putting in the work to make an operating system that embodies their vision for how a single operating system can span multiple form factors and all that other good stuff. Styling wise, the fur aside or the fuzzy fabric aside, I still think Microsoft Surface and PCs in general are sticking too closely to the Apple design formula. Like, they have their own twists, they have their own colors, you know, fabric and the weird hinge and all stuff like that, but Apple has so dominated the aesthetic for laptops, basically from the PowerBook days, when they defined the current shape of laptop. Keyboard goes there, pointing device goes here, screen goes there. It took a while for a PC to get on board with that, but that defined it in the same way that the iPhone defined the smartphone form factor. And when Apple came out with the modern MacBook lines with the big flat square keycaps and this little perfect rectangle that Johnny Ive loves and the big touchpad and like all the quote-unquote high-end PC laptops have been following along with that aesthetic as if it is the one and only true way to make laptops, and I don't think it is. There is variety out there, and a lot of that variety is ugly, and you could like, well, I'm glad Microsoft is sticking with the Apple design school because it looks good, and it does, but it also doesn't allow them to stand out. Very often, speaking of coffee shop surveys, I'm in a coffee shop, and I have to squint to make sure I can make out from the front, is that a MacBook Air? Or is it, you know, it's easier from the back because you can see the little Windows logo, which is, you know, better than the old Windows logo, but whatever. Anyway, Apple says that you have to have your company logo dead center in the back of your screen, so that's what they do. But from the front, it's like you could mistake it for a MacBook Air. And I think that is leaving money on the table style-wise, that I believe there can be a different aesthetic that they could be pursuing instead of what they're currently doing, which is like Apple style, but with a twist. So I'm not particularly impressed by this product. I was much more impressed by the Surface Studio Pro, and but all of these products, all Microsoft's hardware products, and even, you know, to some degree, the software products, reveal gaps in Apple's lineup. I'm not going to say they're necessarily weaknesses, but they reveal gaps. Like, their operating system reveals the fact that they're, you know, the things fall through the gaps between iOS and macOS. Whether 1OS, 2OS is the right strategy, either way, it shows gaps. And all these variety of Surface Books and Surface Studio Pro reveal gaps in Apple's lineup, and that, like, if you want a really big touchscreen that runs Pro apps, the biggest you can go on Apple is 12.5 inch. If you want an OS that's touch accessible, that's iOS. You know, and like, there's this big gap between Pro hardware that in theory is coming to the Mac soon, and touch OS, and Apple has separated those two from each other, whereas Microsoft has a combined OS and a combined hardware strategy. So I find that the most interesting thing about the Surface efforts. And I suppose it's interesting that they're extending the branding to a plain old laptop, but this plain old laptop does not seem to be a particularly compelling product beyond the fact that it is a Surface-branded laptop. But I applaud Microsoft for taking the Surface hardware and software brand and extending it outwards, and hopefully they have some success. We haven't even talked about Windows 10S. I don't know if we have time for it, but that is a whole other aspect of this.
We'll get to that. But also, and I think this ties into that too, keep in mind, like, as you criticize this laptop's, you know, mediocrity in certain areas, it's a low-end product. Like, this is a value product. You know, in the world of PCs, it's probably mid-range.
It's a low-end Mac. It's a high-end PC. A low-end PC laptop is $180.
Yeah, that's true. It's a mid-range PC laptop, but it's, you know, because, and you know, it uses those kind of mid-range parts and everything, and it's a pretty small case and everything. So anyway, this is a value product, and it's competing against Apple's value product. And it is interesting to see, like, the two very different ways that Microsoft and Apple are tackling this problem. You know, Apple is largely addressing the very old, unupdated MacBook Air towards the same market. I mean, some of the people will be pushed up into a new MacBook Pro, but I think a lot of people are still, like, you know, this is aimed at things like schools, big, you know, businesses, college students, like people who need either a lot of computers at the lowest possible price, like a school, or like people who are buying a computer who need a lot of value and can't spend a lot more. So things like college, you know, people like college students, things like that. And you know, the MacBook Air is done very well for these people, but you know, Apple is basically just telling them to just keep buying really old hardware, and Microsoft is showing them a new option. And I don't think Apple really has a direct answer to this. I mean, I guess technically Apple's answer is spend more for one of our new computers or tolerate one of our old ones. But I think the MacBook Air is kind of an embarrassment right now, because it's not like this is some, like, you know, narrow little product that they don't sell many of. They sell tons of them. And so it makes me kind of sad for Apple that they are happy to sell so many of an ancient product that they have refused to update out of what seems like a combination of laziness and greed, because they're making good money on it, so why update it? Like, that's a crappy reason, you know, but that seems to be the reason they're using. And the new MacBook Pro will eventually, I assume, will eventually get lower in price, and eventually will, and eventually the 12-inch and the Escape line will replace the MacBook Air. But it doesn't seem like that's happening soon. It seems like that might be like still like maybe 3 years out or something like that. So for this time, are they just going to keep selling this ancient MacBook Air while things like this are coming out from the PC industry and kind of embarrassing it? Like that, I don't think I like that strategy.
Don't we have like 5 years before they have a special meeting to talk about the MacBook Air at Apple's campus that they invite us, like, oh, you know, say, goodness, we know we haven't updated the MacBook Air in 4 years. And people were wondering if we were going to discontinue it, but we've just decided last week that we're going to make a new MacBook Air. Now, it won't be out this year, but we are going to rethink the MacBook. We've heard you that you want the MacBook Air. Like,
yeah, right.
Get this specific Microsoft Surface thing. Like, PC laptops have been embarrassing the Air for a long time. It's not just this one. Like, oh, they finally made it. Like you said, like, there's been tons of PCs that use the MacBook Air class of chip, but they actually stay updated of varying degrees of build quality and style. So maybe the Microsoft one is notable in that they have a good reputation for hardware build quality. And if you like the style, like, that's fine. But yeah, I mean, it's revealing gaps in Apple's lineup. Like, that Apple wanted the combination of the new MacBook and the new MacBook Pros to span the same range that the old combination of the Airs plus the Pros plus the weird MacBooky thing in the middle span. And it does kind of span the same range, just with gaps in different places, but because of the way they're priced and the way their capabilities spread, it ends up being less satisfying. And the Air still is very popular. I don't know if I mentioned this about my UK trip, but I did a because I was actually in a Starbucks, I think for the first time in my entire life, because my wife went in there to get a drink and I came in with her. And I did a laptop count, just because I was, you know, I glanced around and I was stunned at what I saw. What I saw was, like, I think it was like 8 MacBook Airs, 1 HP laptop, and 1 MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
And I was like, MacBook Airs? Like, what's going on? I talked to some people in the UK and they said, oh, schools buy them a lot. Like, when you go to school, you get a laptop and they all buy MacBook Airs. So, like, are these people going to, I mean, are these all old MacBook Airs they got as hand-me-downs? Are people going to Apple stores and continuing to buy MacBook Airs?
Yes, they are.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you look at the ASPs of the, I was thinking of this when you say, oh, the MacBook Pro prices will come down. Like, not if those ASPs stay up, because the new MacBook Pros that are all super, more, you know, more expensive than their old models, tremendously increased revenues and average selling price for Apple. So, because, you know, again, pent-up demand, right, or whatever. But I'm not so sure that they're going to be in a big darn hurry to lower the price. And honestly, I'm okay with Apple jacking up the price on its top-end models, as long as the top-end models, like, justify that price, not linearly, obviously, where it's like, is this $500 better? No, of course it's not going to be $500 better. But if anything you're going to fleece people on, make it the super-duper high-end ones. If they actually introduced a MacBook Air replacement, sort of a worthy MacBook Air replacement that fills that same role, like has the same trade-offs of battery life, screen size, and ports and capability as the old MacBook Air, but has all updated internals and is Retina. If they ever made such a machine,
I mean,
that
did.
Could lower their ASPs, but I think it would sell like hotcakes. And honestly, I feel like, I made the joke about the whole Mac Pro meeting, like, oh, we've decided we're going to do this. I feel like that decision is inevitable, because it seems like the range of capabilities in Apple's limited range, from the super duper skinny MacBook to the much more expensive Pros, that doesn't seem to be the right distribution of price points and capabilities to satisfy the market, right? Whereas the Air has proven itself to be a, you know, and not the first Air, because the first Air was a crappy mix, right? But like the 2011 and on Air, like, that was a really great sweet spot for capability, size, and price. And I think Apple has proven with their experiment that the super duper skinny one, like, it's a little bit too far down the capability ladder. Like, it sacrifices too much capability for other stuff. They just, by all means, keep it, because you should have a model that's like the lightest possible thing you can have. It's awesome for that, right? But it doesn't, whatever the curve looks like of demand for laptop sizes and capabilities, that one is also towards the edge. So I think Apple will eventually come around to making a machine that has... the balance of the MacBook Air. It doesn't have to be the same exact size and shape as the MacBook Air, because things change and USB-C is smaller and so on and so forth. And whether that's because the MacBook evolves, or they introduce a new model in the middle, or the 13-inch MacBook Pro, as Marco has talked about so many times, eventually shrinks down to the point where it basically is a MacBook Air. But that hasn't happened yet. And so looking over at the PC side or the Windows side of things and seeing all these MacBook Air equivalents, seeing how popular, you know, again, coffee shop surveys, a lot of the PCs that I see are MacBook Air-y size form factors. I see less of the giant battleships that you still see in corporate environments, and I see more of the, you know, HP, Lenovo, MacBook Air-y size machines. So hopefully Apple will get on that in, you know, T-minus 2.5 years.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, the strategy, what they're doing, what they seem to be doing now, which is basically, like, just never update the Air and just keep selling it until the other ones come down in price. I don't think that necessarily works unless there's other changes in mind, because, like what you said, like, the 12-inch, assume that comes down in price and becomes a new entry. That's kind of not good enough to replace the MacBook Air. Like, it is so much of a compromise in so many more areas. It is, you know, it has way fewer ports and things. It is way slower than the MacBook Air in a lot of things. It gets worse battery life by a good amount. And those, you know, it will presumably improve over time. Like, maybe the second generation 12-inch MacBook, whenever that comes out, maybe that one will be a better Air replacement. But the current one really isn't. I mean, maybe the answer is that the 13-inch MacBook Escape ends up going down in price eventually, or it has a very low-end configuration. But the problem is, like, the base model is already a pretty low-end model for Apple standards. For, you know, for the, compared to the Surface Book, it's kind of mid-range to high-end. But so again, like, I'm not entirely sure that strategy makes sense, but it seems like Apple is doing a pretty poor job addressing what is probably by far their most popular model of laptop. Like, that seems weird to me. Although that being said, looking at the Surface laptop, if you were buying one of these things, which of these four colors would you get? Because I saw the video, the colors looked okay in the video, but now that I'm seeing this page, like, all four of these colors look hideous to me. They all look like cubicle walls.
Yeah, the texture is the problem, not the color. I think either one of the two grays, the darker gray or the lighter gray, yeah, they're fine, but I'm not on board with the texture thing, both because I think it'll get dirty and gross and it'll be harder to clean, and also because the edge treatment, like, when the fabric runs to the edge and, you know, joins up with the metal, that's just asking for it to fray. And the last thing I want is a frayed laptop. That's not an aesthetic I like. I can imagine people finding it attractive, right? But I'm not into that.
Word. I don't know. It's hard to say. On the configurator, the colors in the image is just microscopic, and it's very hard to say. I would probably take a look at the cobalt blue, but in all likelihood end up with the boring platinum.
Yeah, the colors are right, and you're right that their website, like, I know you just made fun of their website for a while before, but, like, if you have beautiful hardware, like, they made the really cool intro video that I think Gruber linked to and a couple other people did, that shows, like, all, you know, it looked like an Apple video showing how beautiful all the parts are, even on the inside, and how they all assemble and fly together, and we've seen stuff from, like, Apple, like, but then if you go to their website, Apple, the entire page would just be, like, incredibly close-up, high-resolution, beautifully shot photographs / renders of their hardware, right? Whereas here, we're squinting at these little blurry JPEGs. We can't even, you know, I was trying to look for a picture to show me all the ports. Apple would have a shot that's like, your ports fill your entire screen, and they're impossibly clean because they're probably computer renders. And here it's like, I can't even get a shot where I can make out what the ports are on the side. The color picker,
yeah,
changes the
earlier
color on this 1-inch by 1-inch postage stamp. Like, Microsoft, you're not selling your hardware here. You got good-looking hardware. You have to show it off. We want to see it. We want to see it up close. Alas.
That's Microsoft.
I will say also, the MacBook Escape, the late 2016 13-inch MacBook Pro without touch bar, two ports, that it continues to impress me as a machine. Like, and you know, when Phil Schiller got on stage and talked about it during the introduction, he did say something on the lines of, like, this is kind of the new MacBook Air. And even though it starts at $1,500 and has fewer ports and things, I think that is largely correct. I hope in the whatever the next version of the MacBook Escape is, you know, presumably, you know, maybe this fall or next spring, whenever new MacBook Pros come out, I hope that they make a few changes that will make that more correct, that will make this more of a MacBook Air replacement. I think for me, like having used this thing now, I miss the SD card slot. I will not accept any argument that that's the past because it simply is not true. You can argue with me all you want about legacy ports, but the SD card is not a legacy port. It is something else, and it is still necessary for lots of people.
Oh, I could not disagree with you more.
Cool. So I would say bring back the SD card reader, and I would also really like one more USB port. I don't care whether it's C or A. Most of the computers, like in this class before, you've been able to have them plugged in, and you've been able to plug in two devices to them. And you can't do that with this without using hubs and stuff. And every USB-C hub that's out there in the world right now is a total piece of garbage. And the MacBook One has been out for, what, 2 years now?
Something like that.
And they're still all garbage. You know, like this is similar. It's a similar problem of a lot of like hubs and things like hubs that, you know, eventually, I mean, it took me something like 3 years to find a decent USB 3 hub that didn't disconnect constantly and cause problems. Like, every USB-C hub out there is a total piece of garbage. And the fact is, what if I don't want to buy a USB-C hub? What if I don't want to buy Apple's like $75 thing or whatever it is? Like that's just more additional cost for people who are buying this thing to do something fairly basic. I really would love one additional USB port and an SD card reader. And if that happens to come with them also maybe dropping the price by a couple $100 on the entry point so that it makes it more MacBook Air range, I think that would help a lot.
And then make it a little bit thinner, and you've got a Retina MacBook Air.
No, it doesn't need to be thinner. It's already thinner than the MacBook Air. Like, it is, physically, in so many ways, it's great. Like, it really is really nice.
It's not thinner than the MacBook Air in all dimensions. Like, it doesn't do the taper, which, again, I say is a great idea for not doing the taper because you can get tons more battery life. But it doesn't change the fact of how it feels in your hand and how it fits into your like backpack or whatever. Like the taper was there for a reason, for like a perception reason, and that perception is a real thing.
No, I'm telling you, I disagree very strongly on the physical side. To me, physically, this is a MacBook Air. Like it is exactly the right size and feels exactly the right in the hand.
You may feel like it's the right size, but it feels chunkier than the Air.
I disagree.
I can just go get an Air and just like it just does because it doesn't have the thin end. That's the perception angle that I'm talking about. Like, I'm not saying the thin end is the right choice because I think the right choice is for right now for it to be thicker. But you're saying like in the future, eventually, like I was saying, the question is, does the fanless MacBook expand its capabilities to fill in the role of the Air, or does the 13-inch MacBook Pro slim down essentially to come to the MacBook Air and lower its price to come to the MacBook Air from above? And I agree that it's probably more likely that eventually the 13-inch MacBook Pro, if not in price, in all other ways, will fill that same role. But I disagree that right now, that fit, form factor-wise, that it feels the same. Because it just doesn't. We have them at work and pick them up, and it's just not like that. Actually, we don't have them at work. The important people who have their own machines at work have them at work. Sorry. So excited. Like, did work give that to you? No, this is my personal machine.
Do we want to, we are running long, but do we want to talk about the Windows 10S or whatever it's called?
I think this is a quick one. So Windows 10S is the cut down in terms of pricing version of Windows that you can get with these laptops that wants you to get all of the applications from Microsoft's version of the App Store. And, you know, it's a model we're all familiar with. Microsoft has been pushing real hard on the App Store model. Thus far, they have not been as successful as Apple, but in theory, it brings all the same benefits of a controlled selection of software that's approved by Microsoft that conforms to, presumably, better conforms to the ideals that Microsoft wants it to conform to, and that Microsoft gets, the control of how the money flows and yada, yada, yada. The interesting thing about Microsoft 10S is that if you want to get applications from someplace other than the Microsoft App Store, or I don't know what they call it, I keep saying App Store, you can pay them an additional $50, and now you can load programs from anywhere, which is probably making longtime PC Windows people freak out, because this is, like a lockdown PC that I have to pay money to put stuff on. That's terrible. Don't worry, guys. You'll be able to hack it. All that stuff is cracked. Anyway, it's an interesting business model, trying to have your cake and eat it too, where it's like, we want to give people the capability of using it as a regular PC, but we actually want to discourage that. So we can discourage it. And by the way, we can make our cheap models cheaper by, you know, presumably Microsoft is reducing whatever its license fee is by saying, if you use Windows 10S, you PC manufacturer won't have to pay us quite as much for the Windows license, because we hope we're going to make some more by selling apps through our store. But as Gruber pointed out, this is kind of a weird pitch for people that, like, you have to pay money to... Are you paying money to make your thing better? Or are you paying... Or is it just there as a deterrent to try to encourage people to use the App Store? And the Microsoft App Store is pretty grim and, like, doesn't have the apps that you want in it, so does everybody just have to pay that fee? I don't know. Like many things they do in the Microsoft, the modern Microsoft Surface world, it's like, I don't know, let's try this. And, you know, they don't have too much to lose. It's not like they're... The Microsoft App Store is setting the world ablaze, so... If this is what it takes to encourage more people to get into the Microsoft App Store, to say, you know, if they sell a lot of these, then they can say, hey, look at all these customers. The only place they can buy stores is through the Microsoft Store. That's why you, software developer, should put your stuff in the Microsoft Store. But, you know, good luck getting the big names in there. The same reason Apple couldn't get them in. Microsoft's going to have trouble getting them into the store. And then it just ends up being as a weird free version of Windows that you can pay $50 to unlock, and presumably to remove all the weird ads that are apparently in Windows these days.
Yeah, this whole thing is kind of a weird segmentation thing. I mean, it is obviously like this effort to create like a low-end Windows, but like Windows RT was, you know, kind of a more severe version of that, and that didn't do so well. I really don't see Microsoft's customers being a big fan of this.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the thing that deserves a $50 charge. It seems to me to be like the gatekeeper switch in OS or Mac OS, where you just kind of say, "Yes, I understand the risks. I'm good with it. Just let me sideload whatever I want."
Yeah, that was the Gruber's analogy too, and it's like it doesn't feel good. It feels like a ransom. It's like, unlock the full capability of your PC, but that's just from our perspective, because we're like, oh, we just expect to be able to load any software we want on our PCs. And of course, from our perspective in the walled garden of Apple, it's like, we would gladly pay $50 to be able to sideload arbitrary applications onto our iPhones, or at least that was, I think all the geeks would have agreed on that many years ago. These days, people make less of a fuss about that, but I think it still exists for all sorts of applications that Apple doesn't allow in the App Store that might potentially be useful, so on and so forth. But, trying to bring that to the Windows world, I don't know what kind of demand is there for that, and I'm not sure how much power Microsoft has, even with its own, within its own ecosystem, to make that happen. Apple obviously took the easy way out and said, we're introducing a new platform, this is how it is from day one, right? So then it's like, it is what it is, and guess what? That platform was wildly successful, so they made it happen. But trying to retroactively apply that to a platform that was previously opened, Apple, and it's on its own little private world of the Mac, has had much difficulty doing that, you know, with Mac App Store and sandboxing and major applications that either never in the store, Mac App Store, or left the Mac App Store. And I think Microsoft's going to have an even harder time of it. But I think mainly the main innovation here seems to me as a way that Microsoft can allow even cheaper Windows-based computers while still hopefully not losing that much money on them. Giving Windows licenses, you know, lowering the price of Windows licenses so for computers that are incredibly cheap, and hoping they're going to make it up with App Store purchase. I don't think the math will work out for them, but it's an interesting strategy. And from a user's perspective, I think Windows users are just used to by now the business model of Windows and how many different versions there are and how much they cost and what you really have to pay and what they're capable of doing being a confusing mess. And so, you know, this is par for the course.
Thanks a lot to our sponsors this week, Casper, Betterment, and Indochino, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental. Accidental. They didn't mean to. Accidental. Accidental.
I have some thoughts about the Switch.
Oh?
It's okay. It'll be fairly quick. This week, really last week, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe came out. This is the first Mario Kart that I have played since Mario Kart for the Wii. And it came out on Friday. I got my copy on Friday. On Monday, I had already arranged with a few coworkers at work who also have Switches. We were all going to bring our consoles in and our copies of Mario Kart and play over lunch. And so there were six of us gathered around a kind of a bar, if you will, at work, playing local multiplayer against each other and with each other on Mario Kart 8. And it was unbelievably fun and cool, and a miracle that HR didn't come down and yell at us for the language that we were all using as we were hollering at each other to, you know, effectively go die in a fire, but with much more colorful words than that. It was unbelievably fun, just like Apple. Like Apple used to be anyway. It just worked, and it was great. And I had just an unbelievable amount of fun in a way that I haven't since I did like LAN parties when I was in high school or college, or null modem cable parties when I was a grade schooler. And this is the first console that I am aware of where that sort of thing can happen in person really, really easily and without six associated TVs as well. I just thought it was extremely cool. Yes, well, actually, yes, I'm aware that the original Game Boy had like four-player games and things like that. But you know what I mean, where six people show up with no cables whatsoever and just start playing a game together. It was awesome and tremendously fun. And if you happen to know a couple of people, or even better, a handful of people who all have Switches and all have Mario Kart or maybe an equivalent game, I cannot recommend it enough. It is so much fun. Have you done any of this yet, John?
I looked for you online at Mario Kart this weekend, but you weren't around. Yeah, I've played all these tracks and done all these things already, but I played it to just see the new frame rate and the higher res graphics and the new features of the game.
What game was it again?
Mario Kart 8.
Oh, what was it again?
Are you trying to get me to say Mario over and over again so you can soundboard me? Still Mario Kart 8. Deluxe. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe.
Indeed.
But yeah, and to try out the few new features they added with the double item boxes and the pink sparks and the dreaded auto steer thing, which you must disable because it's terrible. Well, it's terrible for me. It is good for the people who it's intended for. I would have loved to have, speaking of the auto drive thing, it's not auto drive, it's preventing you from going off the edge of the map. And I used to try to play Mario Kart with my kids, probably before they were quite old enough to be able to do it. And it was very frustrating for them because they couldn't stay on the course, right? I think they would have had more fun with this version, which has auto accelerate so you don't have to hold down A. And also, they can drive all over the course however they want. They just can't go off the edge. It's as if there are guardrails on the entire track. And that would have really helped them, you know, be guided along. But if you are an experienced Mario Kart player, you don't want this feature on, because if you barely get close to or touch the edge and you weren't going to go off the edge, but you just happen to touch it, it slows you down tremendously. It's like, you know, it's like sandpaper. So I would encourage everyone to turn this feature off if you're going for good lap times or trying to compete in 200cc or whatever. You can't turn it off from the main interface. You have to actually start the race. And then once the race has started, go to the options screen and then you can turn it off. And I'm pretty sure that setting persists between launches of the game once you have turned it off.
Now, the thing, though, with this is that it's very different than playing online against each other, because, you know, when you're playing online against each other, you can't, unless you have like a phone line open, you can't really yell and scream at each other like you can when you're face to face. And you can't see, you know, the people who are steering their Switches, even though they're not using tilt controls, they're steering their Switches like steering wheels because they can't help themselves. You can't see the delicious frustration when you nail the person in first place with a blue shell. You can't see all that online. And so, although the online play is also very good and also generally just works, it is just magnificent to have a big group all in person. So if we do a podcaster family New Year's again this year, I will pretty much demand everyone bring their Switches in Mario Kart because it is extremely fun. Also, I noticed buried deep within Nintendo's Mario Kart site, and I will not put a link in the show notes because I will forget and I'm too lazy to find it, you can actually play 12-player local Mario Kart over Ethernet only, which I didn't even realize was the thing. So you would have
An Ethernet port?
No, that's the thing. You would have to get 12 USB to Ethernet adapters and a router and 12 TVs because you have to be docked to do it. But you could play 12-player Mario Kart in a LAN party scenario.
That sounds like an incredibly ridiculous amount of setup, but that sounds awesome.
How fun would that be, though? Yeah. Right? Like, that would be so much fun.
Oh, yeah.
But to go back a sec, John, you were saying you were looking for me over the weekend and didn't see me. One of the complaints I do have about the online setup with the Switch, and maybe it's user ignorance, so maybe I'm dead wrong about this, but I don't see any way where you can, like, notify somebody else, I would like to play this game with you. You can say in Mario Kart that you're looking for a friend that's online, and you can start a room that's intended, or I guess maybe the only two people that can go into that room are, say, me and you. But there is no mechanism that I'm aware of where you can, like, ping or notify a person. So let's say I'm playing Mario Kart. I'm actively playing Mario Kart. And John starts up his Switch and sees me online and says, oh, I'd like to play Casey. I don't think I am ever notified that you are asking to play with me, which is a real bummer because then you have to, like, go to some other device to orchestrate the thing and then back to the Switch to actually play. And I feel like that's a real shortfall, which really bummed me out. But other than that, it's worked really well. Now, that being said, yesterday we also did a group game, this time with 7 players. And I don't know if it was because it was over lunch and we were standing relatively close to microwaves, which is the same story it was on Monday. But either way, the local LAN was not working well at all. And the online multiplayer actually worked pretty much flawlessly. So even though we were all sitting within at most, you know, 10 feet of each other, and even when we moved away from the microwaves, it still just didn't work for Beans for some reason. But once we all went online, it actually worked great. But so much fun to have it in person. And one of the things that appealed to me about the Switch, which I think I've mentioned, you know, last week or the week before, was that intro video where they showed, like, all the Switches all in a circle and they were all playing, like, basketball or maybe a Splatoon or something like that against each other. And I thought, man, that looks so much fun. And you know what? Oh my goodness, it's so much fun. So, John, you really need to try that out. Or, you know, if one of your kids, if their friends all have Switches and they do a slumber party or something, you should just be that creepy old dad that invites himself to play along because it is super duper fun.
Yeah, I have ergonomic issues, though, with using the Switch handheld, which I have tried a few times because so many people are raving about it. But that's just for me personally. I always prefer to have it docked and use a controller and sit on the couch and look at the big TV. And unlike with the Wii U, where I actually thought I did it a little bit better with you playing on the gamepad, maybe because of lag or whatever, like, the Wii U gamepad is way better for me ergonomically than the little tiny Switch. It's just too small and too, you know, I do worse when I race with it in that way than I do on the TV. So I've been playing Mario Kart mostly on the TV. And if I had to do, like, a LAN party type thing, it's nice that we could all be in person and do the things. But I would prefer to be in the ridiculous scenario where there are 12 televisions and Ethernet things, because that's the way I prefer to play the game. I mean, I suppose you could still have fun playing it not at peak level with me trying to play at the handheld thing and doing terribly badly. But and going back to it, I was surprised that I thought, like, oh, I haven't played Mario Kart 8 in so long, I'm going to fire this game up and I'm just going to see how awful I am. But I still had it. Like, I went directly to 200cc, which I had unlocked in the Wii U version already. And I just pulled up a bunch of courses and I was doing pretty well, like, plus or minus the insanity of rubber banding and item bombardment that you get at 200cc with the incredible cheating computer players. I did okay, except for a couple of the tracks that were in, like, I guess they were in the most recent DLC that I had only done a little bit, and I realized I just don't know those courses. But I tend not to like the SNES tracks anyway. It was SNES
what?
Tracks
you
and also,
monster.
I mean, like, they were good in SNES, but I prefer the other tracks that are more dynamic, that are, you know, ports from, like, GameCube and the Mario Kart 8 ones directly. So I had fun. I don't know if I'm going to go through and like three-star everything like I did on the Wii U one, because I find that incredibly frustrating at the upper levels, because three-starring at 200cc will literally drive you mad if you do not have much better skills than I do. Because I can do it, but it takes me a long time, and it's incredibly frustrating to have to three-star, because it doesn't mean just that you come in first at the end of the thing. That means you basically come in first in every race except for one. Like, there's very little or maybe it's all of them. There's very little margin of error. And in 200cc in a world of Mario Kart, it seems to me that almost no amount of driving skill can protect you from an unfortunate series of events that leads you to, after an entire Grand Prix, getting blown up 10 feet from the finish line and watching one person zip by you. And then, oh, sorry, you didn't get three stars. It's a rough world out there, America. I went back to Zelda to relax. I played a bunch of Mario Kart. I'm like, I need to wind down. I need to relax. Went back to Zelda, where I've already beaten the game, and I'm just like, you know, doing the fun side quests and furnishing my home and doing all sorts of exciting things. And that was much better.
You know, it's funny you bring up Zelda again, because I found that since I've gotten Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, I am far less likely to play Zelda, not because I don't enjoy it just as much, not because it's not, by pretty much any measure, a better game, but because with Mario Kart, I can pick it up for like a 3-minute or 10-minute, you know, round and just kind of play for a few minutes, put it back down. Whereas for me anyway, with Zelda, I have to be like concentrating and paying attention and thinking about things. And I understand that I'm a noob, and maybe other people like you, John, that have played Zelda for forever and a day don't have to concentrate as much. But for me, it's a much more deliberate act. And so I've found myself playing a lot more Mario Kart than Zelda since Friday, even though in many ways I enjoy Zelda more. And in many ways, I do think it is more relaxing, or at least a slower pace, if nothing else.
I think that Zelda is one of the games that is the easiest to pick up and do something. One of the easiest Zeldas perhaps ever to have a tiny short gaming session, because you'll pick up and like, there are so many things that you can choose to do within 2 or 3 minutes. You don't have to go and do a shrine or advance the story. You can just pick a point on the map and, you know, fast travel there, or like pick a point close by and just go to it. And along the way, you will find enemies to defeat, new things, especially if you haven't opened up the entire map yet and you're just exploring. Interesting things to see. Just look and say, I wonder what's over there, and go over there. And when you get there, you find out what's over there, and it's an interesting thing, and you're done. Like, when I was super duper into playing Zelda, like when I was only like 10 or 20 hours in, it was, you know, normally we just play games on weekends, but I was at the point where, you know, after dinner on weekdays, I was like, let me just get in 5 or 10 minutes of Zelda, because there was always something to do. So you should, like, maybe if you're going into it and saying, I need to advance the story, I need to get closer to finishing the game, that there is some sort of like, oh, where was I in my project of finishing this game?
That's exactly what I run into, is I lose my context, and then it takes me like 10 minutes just to remember where I was. And a lot of that is just because I have a terrible memory, and I forget. But I think you're right. If I don't worry about what I was actively in the midst of working on, it probably would be a lot more approachable.
Yeah, like, save that for the longer sessions, and for the shorter ones, like, just gather up some food and cook it, or go, you know, beat up some bad guys and take their stuff, or see what's over on the other side of that hill, right? And then only if you're going to have a longer gaming session, say, okay, now how am I going to progress? What area of the map am I going to open up and conquer next? What story thing am I going to go on? Am I going to pick a side quest for my adventure log and do that one side quest? That's for the longer sessions.
Marco, you still haven't really played the Switch at all? Are you still with us?
Yeah, I bought Mario Kart, I think yesterday, the day before. But I haven't been able to play it yet on my Switch, because I was told by Tiff that I couldn't play with her Switch. And I suggested that maybe I should bring it to WWDC.
You absolutely should, but she'll kill you.
And then we could all play on our Switches. But then I was also informed, what would she do that week without her Switch?
And also, I would never bring mine.
Why?
Were you afraid of scratching the screen that you never look at?
No, it's not a portable device for me. I'm not going to bring it. Do I need more? I'm not even bringing, I don't even bring laptops anymore. I just bring my iPad. I don't travel light. It would take a lot for me to bring the Switch, because then you have to bring all the stuff to, you know, at the very least the charging cable, and I would want to bring the Pro Controller, and then it's like, I would never play it.
Yeah, I don't have to bring all the stuff. I just bring the Switch, and I use the cable for my MacBook Pro to charge it if I need to.
Right, exactly. And it's actually, I'm glad you brought all this up, brought all this back up, because when you had said, you know, you only want to play it against the TV and you don't like it in handheld mode, blah, blah, blah. That's totally fair. Totally reasonable. For what it's worth, when we were set up at work, a handful of people did bring their Pro controllers. But what I did, for example, is I, because I didn't have a Pro controller until about 4 hours ago, I put it in kickstand. You know, I put the kickstand up and then popped out the Joy-Cons. And in my case, I slid them into the little sheath. I don't know what the term is for that, the holstery thing. So it was kind of like a poor man's Pro controller. But what a couple of people did was just hold their Joy-Cons. They just held them, you know, at their sides or whatever.
Yeah, I tried playing like that too to see how it was. And like, I think that was better than holding the whole thing up. But then I had the problem of what to do with the screen. If you have a table, then you can use the little kickstand. But if you're trying to do it like on your lap, then you have some problems.
Oh, it's big still, time.
It's still not for me. And same thing with Zelda. I also tried playing Zelda in all these arrangements. Handheld with the Joy-Cons on, handheld with the Joy-Cons off, on a table, on that. And it's just like TV wins for me. I have two Pro controllers now. I'm committed to the Pro controller lifestyle.
Fair enough. And I mean, again, I'm not at all trying to argue. All I'm saying is that I think for a friendly and lightly competitive match at WWDC, I really think you'd be fine with just having the Joy-Cons in your hands, perhaps without the holstery thing. And presumably we'd all be around a table or something like that and just playing in that way. Although I will say that would be a pretty fun way to pass the time while we're waiting both outside and inside, whatever the convention center is called, Moscone for the sake of discussion. That would be a pretty good way to deal with just sitting there for hours. Just saying.